Well, greetings, everyone. I'm George Gordon. Gather round, let me tell you the story about the law. These discs now take the place of my general law tape. And there are about as many opinions about this thing called law as there are people to opine about it. If any one of those opinions were true, then all of the rest would have to be false, wouldn't they? Now, confusion abounds, and the blind lead the blind, and they all fall in the ditch. Now, I teach law here at the Gordon Law School. I teach pro se litigation to people just like you, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. Housewives, doctors, dentists, truck drivers, plumbers, carpenters, electricians, businessmen all come to school here, and they all have one thing in common, and that is they're all subject to the law. And we're all involved in the law, whether we like it or not. And that's because we all have driver's licenses that bind us to thousands of traffic rules and regulations. Most people don't know how many traffic laws and regulations there are in their code, but they have a driver's license for which they have voluntarily agreed with the state that they will obey them all. We have business licenses that bind us to the Uniform Business and Professions Code. The average businessman or professional wouldn't have a clue as to where to find that code with both hands at high noon and a map. We have marriage licenses that subject us to the Department of Family Services, the Welfare Department, child support laws, but we don't understand those laws, we don't know what those laws are, and those laws are being added to by the legislature every session, but you don't know anything about them. And government prosecutes all of us for any violation of these laws. And the question arises, well then, how do we cope? How do we defend? Well, I've developed 8 schools to teach citizens, just local Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives, the average run-of-the-mill carpenter, plumber, electrician, the blue-collar workers, and the professionals. So whether you're a professional or a blue-collar worker, the law affects you just like it does me. And the question arises, how do we defend? The 8 schools are tax and status, courtroom strategy and procedure, my private business school, civil rights, subsistence and survival, how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less, family law, and the Mosaic Law School, the law that everyone believes is abolished, repealed, nullified, archaic, harsh, done away with, and nailed to the cross with Jesus. Well, let's start with the income tax. Well, it's not over till it's over on April the 15th. You know, if you stop, for example, to buy a pizza on a Thursday night to celebrate being done with the IRS for another year, the tax man will be right there to grab a slice or two of that pizza. On top of paying the sales tax, you will also be picking up a major chunk of what the government charges or taxes that pizza store owner for local property taxes, unemployment insurance taxes, federal payroll taxes, federal and state and local income taxes, and workers' compensation insurance. Altogether, according to a study by the Americans for Tax Reform, that comes to $3.80 on a $10 pizza. Think of that. 38% of the price of that pizza is tax. Now, if you pick up a Bud six-pack to go with the pizza, there's another 43 cents of each beer dollar that goes straight to the tax man to pay the excise tax, income tax, property taxes, and so on. For something a little stronger, let's say you want to drink some Jack Daniels or Wild Turkey, then the tax man share is $7.20 on average out of every $10 bill that you spend on booze. Now that's 72%. 72%. What does the government do to produce that bottle or that fifth of Jack Daniels for which the government ought to be paid 72 cents? Now go a little lighter and just drink, say, Pepsi Cola. That's 35% of what you pay for that Pepsi Cola goes to taxes at all levels. Now add some Marlboros and it's 75% on a pack of cigarettes. That's right, 75% of the retail price that's funneled directly into the state's coffers. Now get home and hit the light switch and another 26% or $26 out of every $100 bill that you spend on electricity goes to the government rather than for or to the production of electricity. Now, if you're up and flying the next day, the tax man is up early and waiting at the airport for you, and the government pockets $40 on every $100 bill that you spend on an airline ticket. And he's there in the hotel lobby when you land, snatching 43%. $43 of every $100 that you spend in the hotel goes to tax. When you go out to dinner, it's another 28%. That's $28 out of every $100 bill of the tab that ends up with the government rather than with the restaurant. You know, the restaurant, the farmers, the truckers, and everyone else who work together to produce the meal make less than $28 out of every $100 bill that you spend. The people who actually produce that meal don't get as much as the government does, and the government does absolutely nothing to prepare it. Now, at each and every stop, in items large and small, the greedy hand of government has its sticky fingers in every pocket with bread. A recent study by Price Waterhouse shows that there are 30 different taxes imposed on the production and sale of something as common as a loaf of bread. And it accounts for 27% of the average retail price. So more than a quarter of the price of the bread is in tax. Now buy some tires. That's 36%. $36 out of every 100 goes to the tax man on a set of tires. Now on the price of a new car, an Americans for Tax Reform study shows that the total tax reaches 45% of the showroom sticker price. 45% of the sticker price is taxed. Add some gas, and 54% of what you pay for a fill-up goes for 43 different federal, state, and local taxes rather than to the oil producer, the retailer, or anybody in between who actually drills the oil well, produces the oil, ships it, refines it, produces it, delivers it, and pumps it into your tank. Now, at the start of our nation's unique experiment with individual sovereignty and limited government, taxation without representation was called tyranny. That was the watchword of the American Revolution. For our founding fathers, a level of taxation of only a few cents on a dollar siphoned off to a faraway and arrogant bureaucracy in England was enough to ignite a revolution, enough to grab the trusty musket off the wall. Today, in contrast, if we dare to startle the more panicky among us by buying a good rabbit gun, the government's there at the cash register to check our papers and then seize $46 of every $100, 46% of the price of that gun goes to taxes. And all of this, of course, this immense pile of hidden taxation is stacked on top of our local property taxes and our local, state, and federal income taxes. Is there a way out? Well, not so easy. Let's suppose that you act up and phone the IRS bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. and you complain about our out-of-control government, and the tax man grabs another $1. That's 50% of every $2. That's a dollar out of every two. 50% of what you spend on your telephone bill goes to taxes. Then if you get discouraged and get drunk, it's another 43% or 72% out of every dollar that you spend that gets siphoned off to the state, depending on whether it's Coors or Wild Turkey. For the average family, all of these taxes now eat up 38% of your total gross income. 38% of your gross income. Now, that's a higher rate of taxation than ever before in the peacetime history of the United States. Now, if you'll think about it, 38% of your gross. You don't have a dime to spend until after you have paid 33% of your gross to income tax and Social Security, because the Social Security tax takes 15.3% to 16.1% right off the top, for which then the lowest tax bracket is 17%. That's 17% to 45%. Then you get to pay your property taxes and gasoline taxes and all the rest of the taxes, of which there are 14 taxes that you pay that consume approximately 75% of everything you create and produce. Well, we're now at the absurd point where the typical family works until noon of every working day to satisfy the tax man, paying more in taxes than you spend on food, clothing, and housing combined. So you know there's three things that you have to live. That's food, clothing, and shelter. You're now spending more on taxes than you do on the basic necessities of life. Now today, with 480 different tax forms, 17,000 pages of laws and regulations, and a federal tax code that's more than 7 million words compared to only 773,000 words in the Bible. That's right, 773,000 words, and that's in both the Old and New Testament, compared to 7 million words just in your federal tax code. That doesn't include your state or your local tax code. Nearly 60% of Americans are paying a professional to help them negotiate this tax maze. And every year, the IRS sends out 8 billion pages of forms and instructions, enough paper to stretch 28 times around the earth, to conform with this federal Rube Goldberg tax code. Americans are spending 5.4 billion hours and $200 billion a year just in compliance costs. Not counting the taxes paid, just the compliance cost is $200 billion a year. Now, to give you an illustration, how much money is $200 billion a year? Well, it's more time and money than it takes to produce every car, every truck, and every van every year in the United States. That's right. If you took the entire automobile industry, we spend more money on just income tax compliance than the entire auto industry. Isn't that just special? Now, when this federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied on only the super wealthy. It was the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of about 7%. Today, of course, the fears of these early opponents of the tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. By the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th before earning enough to satisfy the tax man at all levels, and this year the average American family will work all the way through until May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. May 12th. That's called Tax Freedom Day. You ever heard that term, Tax Freedom Day? Back in 1932, in the Idaho Supreme Court, they made a pretty startling statement here. This comes from Diefendorf versus Galea. Let me tell you a little story here about the income tax from the Supreme Court of Idaho. And they kind of tell us a little piece of the story. Because in the tax protest movement, or the Patriot movement, You oftentimes hear the term or the statement made that the tax code does not tell us what the income tax is. Nowhere in the tax code is there a definition of income tax. Well, that's not true. The tax code does have the definition of the income tax contained in it, but most people who are not trained in law can't find it. So let me point it out to you. Here in the Idaho State Tax Code, the Supreme Court, in a case called Idaho, this is Diefendorf versus Galay, this is the Idaho Supreme Court, they said income is defined as, all right, now get your pen and paper out, sharpen your pencil on both ends, because here comes the definition for income. In case you've always wondered, what is it? Now I'm going to tell you. Income is defined as something. Write that down. S-O-M-E-T-H-I-N-G. You got it right straight out of the Supreme Court of Idaho. Income is something. And whatever this something is, it is derived from property. Got that? I knew you'd love it. Income is defined as something derived from property, labor, skill, ingenuity, or sound judgment, or from two or more in combination. Cited in Stony Brook Rail Corporation versus Boston and Maine Railroad Company. 260 Massachusetts, 379. So the Idaho Supreme Court cited it from the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Now, the income tax has been around for a long time. You see that in Schaefer versus Carter. Yeah, the very first income tax imposed in the United States was in New York State in 1778. Did you get that? Write it down. 1778, New York State, first income tax. That's just 2 years after the Declaration of Independence. Now, the same meaning, this court goes on to say, appears to have attached to the term property in all subsequent taxing legislation and in the taxing practices of the executives, and we take judicial notice. Judicial notice. That means you don't have to come in here and prove this. We take judicial notice. It's common knowledge in law that income as such has never been assessed or taxed as property in the state of Idaho. Common knowledge. Common practice. Courts take judicial notice that income has never been assessed or taxed as property. Income is not property. Now, here's an interesting concept. Did you know that property has never been assessed or taxed in the United States of America under our Constitution? That's right. See, property is a right. Rights can't be taxed. Ah, so there's something about this income. Did you know that income is called an excise tax? Just two kinds of taxes, two types of taxes. Under our Constitution, we have two taxes. It's direct and indirect. Isn't that amazing? That's easy to learn. Direct and indirect. It's almost like up and down, left and right, direct and indirect. Well, a direct tax is where we come to everybody and we say everybody pays $2. That's a direct tax. But an indirect tax is a tax where, like gasoline, we go in and buy a gallon of gasoline for $1.25, and there's 43 taxes on that, but you don't know what those taxes are. Those are called hidden taxes. Somebody else paid the tax, and then he just passed it on in the cost of goods sold. Now, on page 633 of Diefendorf versus Galay, listen to this. This is a real neat statement. It says, income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income. The state furnishing the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, receive, and enjoy it, and a tax thereon in the last analysis is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. Isn't that risk real special? Listen to this again. Sharpen your pencil. Listen up. Income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income. Now, what is it when we have a joint effort? You know, if you and I were working together in a joint effort, what would we call that? It's called a partnership. So income is necessarily the product of the partnership of the state and the recipient of the income. You, Joe Sixpack, receive an income. And this income is not property. Because if it was property, Joe, we couldn't tax it. So whatever it is that you're doing to create and produce this income, it isn't property, and you have no property right in this income. Now, you know, in olden days, we didn't make income, we made increase, and we paid a tithe on our increase, which was property. Today, we pay a tax. We pay a tax on our income, which is not property. It's an excise privilege that we receive from government. Now, we have converted then our right to property to an excise privilege. Here's the next statement, or the next sentence. It says, the state furnishes the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, receive, and enjoy it. So the state, one of your two partners here in this limited general partnership, furnishes the protection necessary. Necessary protection. What kind of protection did you need, Joe? Oh, you needed unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, and 108 benefits under the Social Security program called the safety net. Remember, George Bush said, what Americans want are jobs, 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 and we have to have a safety net. Well, gee, Joe, you got to pay for the safety net, don't you? And so we pay an income tax, which is an excise tax, on a joint venture, a partnership between you and the state. And the state furnishes the protection, the insurance, the limited liability necessary to enable you, Joe, the recipient, to produce, receive, and enjoy this income. Isn't that just real special? The state makes it possible for you to produce, receive, and enjoy this income. Not property, income. A franchise. So the tax, this income tax thereon, in the last analysis, is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. Hey, you know, you got a partner, and your partner, he produces something in this partnership to enable you to make this income. And so the state comes along and says, gee, Joe, shouldn't you pay me a portion? So if you're wondering why the state takes, in some cases, 72%, 43%, 45%, 38%, the state is just taking its share of a partnership agreement. Now, I know you're probably sitting there saying, well, why, I never made any agreement with the government. Well, you didn't make any agreement that you knew about. But you have an agreement. You have a partnership. You have a contract. In fact, you have a contract in writing. Yeah, that's right. It's in writing. A written contract. It's called Social Security. Social Security. Now listen to this. In labor and labor relations, cited from 48 American Jurisprudence, second edition, section 1. I'm on page 80. In labor laws, the term labor may be used in a comprehensive sense as including those who toil with their brains as well as those performing manual work. So whether you're working as an insurance salesman or agent, or whether you're digging ditches or driving a truck, in labor laws, the term labor may be used in a comprehensive sense as including those who toil with their brains as well as those performing manual work. So if you're working at a bank, that's called labor. Now, the constitutional protection of your right to work is in Section 2, when it says, the right to labor and to its protection from unlawful interference is a constitutional as well as a common law right. Every man has a natural right to the fruits of his own industry. Isn't that kind of neat? So, the right to labor and to its protection from unlawful interference is a constitutional as well as a common law right. The common law goes clear back to Moses at Mount Sinai. And a constitutional right goes back to 1787. And every man, and that includes you ladies too, and every woman has a natural right to the fruits of your own industry. What you create and produce is yours. You got a right to it. 100% of it. Isn't that kind of neat? Now, you go to work for General Motors and they pay you $10 an hour. You work for 40 hours and at the end of the week they give you a check for $400, right? Well, dream on, because you're going to get a check for about $310. They're going to take $90 out and send it to your partner. Your partner. And in some cases, partners. You know, like the labor union, they get a share called dues. And then, of course, the Social Security Administration, they're a partner, and so they get a cut, 16.1%. And then, of course, there's the government, the income tax, and they get a cut of it. And then there's a bunch of other taxes over here that you're paying for that you contracted for. Isn't that kind of neat? Now, labor is deemed to be property. Property has never been assessed or taxed in the United States. Labor is deemed to be property. Somebody said to me one time, well, they're taxing my labor. Oh, no, no. No, sir, government doesn't tax your labor. That's against the law. Now, picture this. You go to work at General Motors. You work there 40 hours. That's labor. At the end of the week, they give you $400, less $90. So you get net $310, and your partners take $90. And you say they're taxing my labor. No, they're not. They're taxing the dollars. They're taxing the unjust weights and balances that are prohibited in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36, and Deuteronomy 25. Oh, I guess it's about 13 through 16. All right, so let's picture this and understand it. You see, God comes along and he says, I want you to practice strict liability. And we came along and said, God, you dum-dum, you don't understand international high finance. We need to practice limited liability with insurance. And in order for us to do that, we have to have commercial paper. So God comes along and says, now I want you to use gold and silver coin called just weights and balances and deal in property instead of commercial paper. And we said, God, you just don't understand. We have to fix your mistake. Now, we understand that you're kind of old-fashioned and you made these laws 3,100 years ago, not understanding the modern American economy. So we have to have insurance. We have to have unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, and a whole host and plethora of other limited liabilities that are furnished by government. In order to finance this, we have to have commercial paper like mortgages, bonds, stocks, Federal Reserve notes. And in order for us to have all of this, we then have to have taxes in order to support and pay for this government which oversees all of this limited liability, and the tax is on the dollars, not on your labor. And you see, you went in and signed a Social Security agreement. When you got your Social Security card, you agreed under the terms of the contract called the Social Security Act of 1935, codified at Title 42, Section 301 through 335. There's the contract. See, most of you couldn't have found that contract at high noon with both hands and a roadmap, but now I just told you where it's at. Now you can go find it. You should read your contract, because that's the contract that takes 16.1% of everything you create and produce. And do you know that you couldn't pay an income tax without a Social Security number? Because that's your taxpayer identification number. Did you know that? Oh, yeah, I'll show you that here in a couple of minutes. So labor is deemed to be property, but you don't have any property in your labor because you contracted it away. And this is especially true within the meaning of the constitutional guarantees. But, of course, your constitutional guarantees give way to your right to contract. So go to Article 1, Section 2, and you'll see that government is prohibited from interfering or impairing your right to contract. So you have a right to contract with Social Security, the government, or anybody else, and you can give away your rights. So the right to acquire property, then, includes the right to acquire property by labor. So you have a right to labor and to acquire property by labor. Why did you contract that right away? Why did you give it up? Well, for the same reason that people join the army. You see, you have a right to liberty, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and then you go down and sign an enlistment contract with the army and impair your liberty for 2, 4, or 6 years. Well, it isn't that you can't. I mean, everybody has a right to enslave himself if he so desires. In fact, a free man must have the capacity to enslave himself, because if he didn't have that capacity, he wouldn't be free. Ah. So the right to earn wages is just as much property and within the protection of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the Federal Constitution as are earned wages. So the fact that you're earning wages here at General Motors doesn't preclude you from the Bill of Rights and your right to earn wages, and your wages are property, unless or until you contract them away. Now, I would suspect that most of you people listening to me right now have a Social Security number, so you need to pay your income tax. Somebody's going to say, well, my God, you have to have a Social Security number. You couldn't get a job. Oh, no, that's not true. You can work anywhere you want without a Social Security number. Now, your employer told you you had to have a Social Security number, but you never litigated that, now did you? Since the right to labor is protected by the 14th Amendment and numerous guarantees of state constitutions, one cannot be deprived of such right by arbitrary mandate of the legislature, and it merits legal protection. Congress could not enact a compulsory Social Security Act. Social Security isn't compulsory, it's voluntary. And it merits legal protection. Such right is likewise embraced by the 5th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. I don't have a Social Security number. I don't pay the income tax. I don't pay Social Security. But then I don't have any right to Social Security benefits. Now, isn't that just a drag? Now, listen to this. In Hale versus Hinkle, cited at 201 U.S. 43. Back in 1905, conceding that the witness was an officer of the corporation under investigation and that he was entitled to assert the rights of the corporation with respect to the production of its books and papers, we're of the opinion that there is a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. The individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. He's entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. You, the individual, has power to contract, and it's unlimited. You, the individual, owe no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or open his doors to an investigation. You, the individual, you owe no duty to the state, since you receive nothing therefrom. Yet, underline, you receive nothing therefrom. You see, everybody in America receives some benefit from government, and government is right there, Johnny, on the spot to offer you all of these benefits. Benefits. And the individual's rights are such as existed by the law of the land. That's called the common law of the land, long antecedent to the organization of the state, and can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance with the Constitution. Now, on the other hand, the corporation, and when you get a Social Security number, you join this corporate capacity. And on the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state, and it's presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. So Joe, working at General Motors, is presumed to be for the benefit of the public. And you, Joe, receive certain special privileges and franchises. And you hold those subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of your charter. That's the limitations of your Social Security agreement. Now, your powers, Joe, once you have this Social Security number, or you, if you've created a corporation, your corporate powers are limited by law. Corporations can make no contracts not authorized by its charter. Now, take a look at this, Joe. Let's suppose you want to go to work without a hard hat and steel-toed shoes, and you want to work for less than minimum wage. Oh, no, Joe. No. You're going to be fired from off the job. You see, you've got a contract with your employer and the United States government, the state, and the Social Security, the Department of Labor. You know, there's a lot of agencies that are involved in your contract, and they all agree that you have to wear a hard hat, steel-toed shoes, work for minimum wage. That's why we have wage and hour laws. And you follow all those wage and hour laws. You don't have any right or capacity to shed any of those laws. They're called protections. And you have to take them whether you want them or not. So the corporation's rights to act as a corporation are only preserved to it so long as it obeys the laws of its creator. And there's a reserved right in the legislature to investigate its contracts and to find out whether it's exceeded its powers. And that's why, Joe, when the IRS says, we want you to come in here and produce your records and books, you don't have any Fourth Amendment right to refuse to submit those books and records, which later can be used against you in the event that you haven't followed all of these thousands of rules and regulations under the Title 26 tax code. God, isn't that just kind of neat? Now listen, let me turn over here to a few letters from Social Security. You see, when you write a letter to the Social Security Administration and you rescind your Social Security number or your Social Security account, you'll receive a form letter back. Not everybody gets a form letter back. I didn't when I rescinded mine, but a lot of my students have over the years, and they have shared them with me. So here's one from one of my students from the Commissioner of Social Security. And it says, every worker is free to choose employment that is not covered by Social Security. Now, isn't that kind of neat? Now, you're probably sitting there saying, I cannot imagine a single job or a classification of employment in America that isn't covered by Social Security. Well, I can. In fact, the thing that makes your job covered by Social Security is whether or not you're acting in public business and whether or not you have a public contract. Now, I'm George Gordon, and I operate a private law school, and I don't have a Social Security number, and my law school is not covered by Social Security. I'm not entitled to the benefits, and this school is not open to the public. It is by invitation only, and it's private. And that's the difference between opening a school like the University of Missouri, whereas if I was working at the University of Missouri, which has a contract with the government, and all of their employees are in covered employment, and if I want to work there, then I have to have a Social Security number, but I don't have to work there at the University of Missouri. If I did, I'd have to pay income tax and Social Security. So I said, well, I don't want to pay that. I don't want to be subject to wage and hour laws. I want to have rights, freedoms, and I want to be independent. And in order to do that, I have to get into an area that is not covered by Social Security. So not every teacher in America is covered by Social Security, although most are. Now, Social Security, here's the second letter. Social Security is a voluntary system in that no one is required to get a number. Yeah, this is on Social Security. Social Security letterhead, and in my tax and status school, we're on chapter 21. Now, there's 46 lessons in my tax school, 46 things that you need to know about the income tax, and in order for you to make wise choices, that will determine whether or not you give up Social Security or you keep it. I'm not here to tell you that you shouldn't have Social Security or that you shouldn't pay your income tax or that you should quit your job and go do something like I'm doing. I just open a school and give information and show you where the laws are, like Social Security is located at Title 42, Section 301 through 335, so that you can make a choice. Notice this, that no person, or however, a person with no Social Security number would have no taxable income. This is from Social Security. A person with no Social Security number would have no taxable income. And there's no law requiring a person to apply for a Social Security number, and there's no section of Title 18 of the U.S. Code making it a crime not to have a Social Security number. Now, here's a kicker. You'll love this one. This actually doesn't come from the Social Security Administration. It comes from Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce, cited at 168 Fed 2nd 709 on page 712. Listen to this. The revenue laws are a code or system in regulation of tax assessment and collection. They relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers. And no procedure is prescribed for non-taxpayers, and no attempt is made to annul any of their rights and remedies in due course of law. With them, Congress does not assume to deal, and they're neither of the subject nor of the object of the revenue laws. Taxpayers and non-taxpayers recognized by Congress here in Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce. Now, if you'd like to learn more about the income tax, and if you'd like to drop out of the income tax system, I'd be more than happy to show you how to do that. But don't think for a moment now that you can do that just by making an announcement that I'm no longer a taxpayer. You know, people have been doing that for a long time, and they go to jail when they do. So remember the telephone number here at the law school, 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you want more information, go to my webpage, georgegordon.com. That's georgegordon.com. And if you'd like, just click onto the email machine, send me an email request, and we'd be more than happy to talk to you about our tax and status school, give you a calendar, and tell you when the next school is going to be. All right, let's take a break here, and we'll come right back, and we'll take up this thing of courtroom strategy and procedure, because, you know, if you're going to drop out of the tax system, you might end up in federal court. And if you do, what are you going to tell the judge when he asks the question, how come you're not filing and paying your income tax, Joe? Hang on. All right, let's shift gears here and let's go to courtroom strategy and procedure. You know, 90% of the trial lawyers of America are incompetent. How do I know that? Because our Chief Justice, Warren E. Burger, back in 1978, speaking in Las Vegas, Nevada, to the National Association, or the National Bar Association, said 90% of the trial lawyers are incompetent. You know, if I could train you to be competent, you would be superior to 90% of the trial lawyers in America. There are 188 rules of evidence, 91 elements to code pleading, 47 extraordinary remedies, and 42 objections. Well, Judge Wenke made an observation. He said that in his 21 years on the bench, he met 5 trial lawyers who knew all 42 objections. That's like an NFL referee who knows, that would be like having a referee in Super Bowl who maybe knows half of the rules of football. Or worse yet, let's suppose there were 5 referees in the NFL who knew all of the rules of football. Come on, guys. Now, when you go into court, you are terrified. Everybody is. And why is that? Because it's Mystery Babylon the Great. Nobody understands what's going on in there. The only guys that really know or are supposed to know are the judge and the lawyers. And you go in there, it's like going to Catholic church. You know, you walk in, and all these people are in there, and some guy's speaking in a foreign language, and these people are jumping up, sitting down, kneeling, and jumping up, sitting down, and kneeling, and everybody seems to know what to do and when to do it except you. You haven't got a clue as to what's going on. Well, that's the way court is. And it's a religious operation. That priest up there wearing that long robe, sitting on the bench, who is doing the ministrations of the church, the state religion. Nobody understands it. Everybody's terrified of it. We don't get caught up in it very often. When we do, we want to plead guilty, pay the fine, and get the hell out of there just as soon as we can. And 94% of the people who go into court and plead not guilty with a lawyer and defend their case lose. Now get that one again. Sharpen your pencil on both ends. Mark this down. 94% of the people who go into court with a lawyer, paid professional advice, plead not guilty with a lawyer, 94% lose, 6% win. Well, my observation was years ago that if you knew absolutely nothing, and walked into court, pled not guilty, defended yourself by getting on the witness stand and telling your story, you could improve your chances of winning from 6% to 16%. Those are the statistics. You don't have to hire a lawyer to lose. I did that. I hired an attorney, paid him $6,000 a year for 6 years, $36,000, did three cases, paid him $5,000 up front for the three cases. Now we're over $50,000, went into court and lost three cases. Woke up one day and I said, you know, I could go into court without a lawyer and lose free. Yeah, it doesn't cost anything to go into court and lose unless you hire a lawyer. Then it costs you a whole bunch to go into court and lose 94% of the time. Now, if you're a good, competent, trained pro se litigant, I mean, you know how to go into court and make your pleadings, get on the witness stand and tell your story, examine witnesses, cross-examine witnesses, and present your evidence, you'll win 86% of the time and lose 14%. Not quite as good as the prosecutors who win 94% and lose 6%. We will win 86% and lose 14%. Now, you could go into court and do that, couldn't you? Now, what does a good lawyer look like? Because that's the first thing that your friends tell you. Whenever you get into legal trouble, they'll say to you without fail, Bob, what you need is a good lawyer. You need a good lawyer. What does a bad lawyer look like? What does a mediocre lawyer look like? Where do you find these good lawyers and mediocre lawyers? Well, looking at Corpus Juris Secundum, this is called CJS, Legal Encyclopedia. I'm in Volume 7, Section 4, The Attorney-Client Relationship. Listen to what a lawyer's duty is. His first duty, that is the lawyer of a duty, his first duty is to the courts and the public, not to his client. Let me repeat that. The attorney that you just hired, paid him $5,000 cash up front, has three duties. The first is to the court, the second is to the public, and the third is to you. His first duty is to the courts and the public, not to you, the client. And whenever his duties to his client conflict with those that he owes as an officer of the court in the administration of justice, the former must yield to the latter. So if the judge the lawyer has to choose between the judge and you, you lose, the judge wins. If the lawyer has to decide between you and the public wins and you lose. I once talked to a public defender. His name was Larry. Larry, the public defender, had been a public defender for 6 years in Richmond, California. I asked him how many cases had he won for his clients, and he looked at me like I was Mork from Ork, and he said, it's not the duty or the job or the responsibility of a public defender to win his client's case. I was kind of surprised. I thought lawyers were there to win your case, whether he's a public defender working pro bono or working for a fee. And I said, well, gee, what is the public defender's job, Larry? And he said, the public defender's job is to protect his client's rights at every stage of the proceeding. Now, for you lay people, maybe you don't understand what that means in lay language. It means my job as a public defender is to protect your rights at every stage of the proceeding. If I succeed in my goal, I will eliminate every appealable error so that when you're convicted, there will be nothing for you to appeal on. It's my job as a public defender is to make sure that when the government convicts you, that conviction cannot be overturned. And that's why you have all these people on death row, many of them innocent, as you saw up in Illinois. And even though they're innocent, they cannot be relieved they can't be reviewed. They can't have their cases reviewed or be released because there's no appealable error. Now, isn't that just special? Here's a second little thingy over here that you ought to know about your attorney, and that is a client. That's you. The client is one who applies to a lawyer or a counselor for advice and direction in a question of law. So you don't know the law, so you go to a lawyer and you pay him money. And he gives you advice and direction. Or you commit your cause to his management in prosecuting a claim, that's when you're the plaintiff, or defending against a suit in court, that's when you're the defendant. One who retains the attorney is responsible to him for his fees, so you have to pay this lawyer, and to whom the lawyer is responsible for the management of the suit. So the lawyer then is responsible to manage your suit for you. That's what you're paying him for. The person who communicates facts to an attorney expecting professional advice is called a client. Clients are also called wards of the court in regard to their relationship with their attorneys. So you create what's known as a guardian-ward relationship. You give your attorney your power of attorney. That's what that means. Power of attorney. You're going to give your power of attorney to your lawyer. He walks in and he defends you. If he loses, you have no right to complain because, after all, that was your guardian. Just like your daddy. Your daddy gets you your vaccinations. From your vaccinations, you have side effects. It's your daddy's responsibility, not the doctor, the hospital, or the pharmaceutical company, because after all, he's your guardian. He decided that that was good for you to have those vaccinations. Listen to James Nielsen. He's a law professor at the Hastings Law School. And he's being used as an example by Jerry Spence in his book With Justice for None. And here's Jerry Spence. He comes in and he says this. He says, I have taught young trial lawyers from across the land for many years in various trial seminars, and to my dismay, I find that most do not know how to conduct the simplest cross-examination or how to get an exhibit into evidence or to impeach a witness with a prior inconsistent statement. Jerry Spence makes $10 million a year as a lawyer. He's one of the 10% of the competent lawyers in America. From time to time, he holds trial seminars, and he instructs those incompetent 90% lawyers. And when he goes in there, he says, I've taught these young trial lawyers from across the land for many years in various trial seminars, and to my dismay, I find that most is 51%, most, over half, lack certain skills such as cross-examination or how to get an exhibit into evidence or to impeach a witness for a prior inconsistent statements. He says, these kinds of skills for an attorney are skills equivalent to a doctor being able to take a patient's blood pressure, examine his tonsils. Oh, wait a minute. Yet these lawyers, without the most rudimentary tools, are thrown into every kind of trial, from wrongful death suits for widows and children to the defense of capital murder cases for the accused. Then he goes on to cite James Nielsen, a professor at the Hastings Law School. He said, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. It's worse than that. How could it be worse than that? It's a fact, he says, that most students graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. Now, how in the hell can you graduate from law school without ever having seen a will, promissory note, contract, or a deed? And a student, he goes on to say, can graduate without ever having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. And he says, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, licensed lawyer issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it is a cruel hoax, fraud, joke. Now, here at the law school, I have a different mission in life. Number one, I'm not trying to educate educated fools. So we don't take lawyers here. Lawyers don't come to law school here. Lawyers go to law school in law schools where they can get licensed, bonded, and insured. Now, I'm a lawyer. I'm just not licensed, bonded, or insured. I can go into court and represent myself all day long. I just can't go into court and represent you. So you can't hire me to represent you in court in your controversy. You can hire me to teach you the law so that you can go into court and represent yourself pro se. I'm also a plumber. I'm not licensed, bonded, or insured. I can't come out and fix your pipes. But you can come here to my plumbing school, and I can teach you plumbing. And then you can go down and get your own homeowner's permit and fix all the pipes in your house. Free. You don't have to pay a plumber. It's what we call do-it-yourself. Americans have been doing it themselves for many, many decades now. If you want to get the job done right, do it yourself. That's all. Do it yourself. Now, I told you that I hired an attorney and paid him some money, went in and did some cases for me. He was a very good lawyer. He was in the real estate end of law. Lawyers specialize in law like doctors specialize in medicine. And no doubt he was a wonderful real estate attorney. Never had a complaint about him in his real estate function, but when he went into court to do a litigation, that is where he had to examine, cross-examine, make objections, and do a case, he wasn't very good. Of course, I didn't know in those days that some lawyers don't practice law in court. They practice law in their offices, writing contracts and doing those kinds of ministerial duties that make them a lot of money, but they never go into court to defend anybody. But, of course, they're licensed to go into court and defend, and so I went in as a plaintiff. And this guy, well, I went in as a plaintiff once, and he lost, and then I went in as a defendant twice, and he lost. So I had a good round of experience, and here's what I discovered. I discovered that after having paid the guy $50,000 over a period of 6 years, we did three litigations, and he lost three out of three. My common sense said to me, I could probably come in here and lose free. I couldn't do any worse, and I doubt if this guy can do any better. And meanwhile, I am paying to train him so that he can come into court and practice. People practice law. Did you ever notice that? They practice. Listen, when you hire a carpenter, a plumber, or an electrician, you don't expect this guy to come out and practice on your electric box or on your pipes. You expect him to know what he's doing and come out and fix them, or to at least tell you it's not fixable, you need a new one. Now, here's a little illustration. You know, lawyers are entrepreneurs. Lawyers are in the business of making money. So Bob Jones University, some years back, they had a little problem. They needed to take it in, and they had lost at the district court level. They lost at the appellate court level, and now the only hope they had left was to go to the United States Supreme Court. So they went into this prestigious law firm in Washington, D.C., and they said, hey, would you represent us in the U.S. Supreme Court? And this prestigious law firm said, for $236,000, we'll stand on our head in the corner and whistle Dixie through a straw hat. So they paid $236,000 to go into the Supreme Court on a discrimination case. Now, anybody who'd been to law school could have researched this out and told the people at Bob Jones, you can't win this case. This is already well settled in law. You're guilty. You broke the law. You're going to have to pay the piper. But the law firm didn't tell them that. The law firm instead said, oh, God bless you, because you are standing up for the Constitution, the First Amendment, and we will work our hearts out for you. And they probably did, on a losing case. Took it to the Supreme Court, and indeed they did lose. That law firm knew or should have known that Bob Jones could not win. But if they'd have said, look, we've looked at your case and all of the transcripts, and we can tell you with certainty that if you go to the Supreme Court, you will lose again. So there's no need for you to spend $236,000 with our law firm to take up our time, effort, and energy, and to waste your money going into the Supreme Court to argue a case that can't be won. Law firms make money representing people, and remember, half the people lose and half the people win, and the lawyers win on either side, just like a stockbroker. He doesn't care whether you're buying or whether you're selling. He makes money every time you trade. So let's understand that lawyers are entrepreneurs and lawyers are liars. And a lawyer will never tell you that you have a losing case any more than a stockbroker will tell you don't buy that stock because it's a loser. That stockbroker is in the business of selling stocks. So if you've got the stock, he's going to tell you, sell it so I can make a commission. And if you don't have the stock, he's going to tell you to buy it because he's going to make a commission. He is never going to tell you the truth. And that's why lawyers are reported to be liars. That is, people instinctively know lawyers cannot be trusted. Now let me tell you a little story here about pleadings. You know, the most important element in the case is this thing called pleadings. You go into court, you know that you're going to plead guilty or not guilty. Nobody tells you, including the judge, that you could also stand mute, plead nolo contendere, plead double jeopardy, make a plea in abatement, or plead non-assumpsit by way of confession and avoidance. Nobody tells you that. Nobody tells you, for instance, that there's a general demur and a special demur, and that instead of pleading, you could demur, and a demur, in effect, is an answer to the complaint. Nobody tells you to answer the complaint and to set up your own defense. Why is that? Well, because there's a thing here called the major and minor premise. Now, the minor premise is this. The prosecutor comes in and he says, you haven't paid your child support. You haven't paid your taxes. And you come in and you plead not guilty and reduce the controversy to a single clear-cut issue of law or fact. If it's an issue of fact, the jury can hear it. And if it's an issue of law, the jury can't hear the issue of law. Only the judge can. And, of course, nobody explained that to you either. And you could have learned all this in the 9th and 10th grades in high school, but nobody taught it to you. I have people tell me, well, Mr. Gordon, you're pretty smart, you know. You can go into court and you can do all this, and that's because you're real smart, you know. Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm not real smart. I'm a high school dropout. I've done 62 cases, and I've won 54. Now, I lost 8. You can't win them all. But my win-loss percentage is around 86%. My wife now has done 17 cases over the last 19 years, and she's won 17 out of 17. She had a little better advice than I had when I did my 62. And I do cases every now and again yet to this day. And our win-loss percentage is about the same. And I can tell you in plain language, like I did the guy who came to me. He was a polygamist down in Murray, Utah, and he said, I've got 3 wives, or at least this was the guy that was representing the committee, his defense committee, that were raising money from the public at large. That's all the polygamists. And said, well, we would like to take this case all the way to the United States Supreme Court. What do you think? And so I researched it out, and I came back, and I said, well, I got some good news, and I got some bad news. Let me ask you a couple of questions here. And he said, well, go ahead. And I said, well, is this Murray, Utah policeman married with a marriage license? And he said, oh, yes, yes. He's legal and lawful and bona fide and licensed and insured and has 3 marriage licenses with his 3 wives. I said, okay. I said, if by chance, could any of these 3 women be related, such as sisters? And he said, oh, yeah, 2 of them are sisters. And I said, okay. Well, in that case, then, we don't need to go any further. I don't need to waste your time. You don't need to waste mine. You cannot win this case. You are going down in flames. You're in violation of both the civil law and the common law. You do not have a religious free exercise argument to make because you've got licenses, number one, and you're in violation of the biblical prohibition against marrying sisters. And this has already been adjudicated in Reynolds versus U.S., and because of that, you're going down in flames and you're going to lose. Now, the law does not prohibit polygamy. I want to emphasize that. In the United States of America, there's no law against polygamy. There is a law against practicing plural marriages with a marriage license, but there's no law against having 2 wives, 6 wives, or 9 wives with no marriage license. So for all of you Mormon polygamists out there, if you have a marriage license with 1 or more of your plural wives, you're in violation of the law. You're in violation of the law of God because you got a marriage license, and you're in violation of the state because you have a contract and you're in breach of contract. It's just that simple. That's what I told the man. And he was sad, and he went away sad, and they went ahead and hired a law firm, and they took the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that case, along with the Reynolds case, demonstrates just exactly what I told you, and that is, he lost. Difference is, I didn't take his money for no good purpose, but the law firm that represented him also knew they were going to lose. But they told him, you just pay your money and come on in here, son, and we'll just argue and we'll just plead and jump up and down, paw the ground, bite the bushes, and do all those things that lawyers are supposed to do to make you feel real good about us. And we'll do everything we can to win, knowing full well that they were going to lose. Now, let me show you a little something here from Chapter 19, Kofler Repi, on considerations preliminary to the classification of defenses. Let me tell you a little story. Let's suppose an MP comes in here and he says to me, George Gordon, you're under arrest for being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. And I say, well, it's true. My name is George Gordon. And now that you're going to arrest me, are you going to take me to the grand jury in Springfield? Are you going to take me up for a preliminary hearing? Are you going to take me in for an arraignment? No, 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 none of the above. I'm going to go right straight to the brig in Fort Lewis, Washington. Am I going to get due process and equal protection under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? No, no, no. I'm going to be prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ. But you say, well, wait a minute, that violates your constitutional rights. No, 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 it doesn't violate my constitutional rights. And if I want to assert my constitutional rights, then I'm going to have to be smart enough to come into this military court and defend. If I'm going to be smart enough to come into this patent court, then I'm going to have to be smart enough to defend. You have to know the rules of court. So I come up before the provost marshal, and he says, now, Sergeant Gordon, you've been charged with a violation of 2204 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice in that you're absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. How do you plead to that charge? And the minute I plead not guilty from that moment on, I cannot win. And neither can you. And when you walk into court and the judge says, how do you plead today, guilty or not guilty? If you plead guilty, you cannot win. If you plead not guilty, you cannot win. If you plead nolo contendere, you cannot win. All right, now you understand that? So when a judge is asking you the question, how do you plead to this charge, he's asking you, do you want the red death pill or the green death pill? It's up to you to be smart enough to say, well, I think I'll pass on both the red and the death green pills. I think I'll take the white life pill, and I think I will answer the complaint with a general demur. And if the judge says, my God, demurs are abolished in federal practice. Okay, but a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case isn't. And that's all that has been changed here from a general demur to a motion to dismiss under Rule 56(12b)(6), or a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case. The names have changed, but the procedures are identical. Now, of course, nobody's explaining that to you now in the 9th and 10th grades, but let me explain it to you. You see, when the prosecutor comes in, he writes up a complaint which contains what's called the minor premise. And that's because if it's assumed that every liability consists of two elements, called a given combination of facts or events plus a rule of substantive law attaching legal consequences to those facts or events, and if it be remembered that in order to state a good cause of action, one need only set out the combination of facts. One need only set out the combination of facts. One need only set out the combination of facts and events. That's all the prosecutor does. He doesn't sit there and explain how you're in violation of the law. He just sets out the combination of facts and events. The court then takes judicial notice of the rule of law without its statement, and the question arises, in how many ways may the defendant resist the alleged liability asserted in the declaration? And the answer is two. Two. You get two things you're going to do. You're going to plead or demur. That's it. If you plead, you're only going to plead guilty or not guilty, because the judge is never going to tell you that you have the right to stand mute, plead nolo contendere, plead double jeopardy, plead an abatement, or a plea of non-assumpsit by way of confession and avoidance. He's just like a carpet salesman. You know, the carpet salesman asks you, do you want the high-low carpet or the shag? He asks you, do you want the green carpet or the red carpet? Do you want to pay with cash or check? You know, he doesn't ask you what you want. He gives you an alternative to choose from. Either alternative, he wins and you lose. And besides that, the judge is working for the state. So pay attention now, boys and girls. When you walk into court and you're looking for a fair trial, fair trial, fair trial, you're not going to get it in court. Not unless you know how to create a fair trial. Let's try this one on for size. You walk into court and you've got a complaint, and the complaint says that you haven't paid your child support, and the complaint says the state of California versus Joe Sixpack. Who is the complaining party? It's the state of California. The state of California is complaining about your behavior or your failure to behave properly. And the state then brings you into state court. This is called a superior court in California, and you go before a state trial judge. This state trial judge is being paid every Friday by who? Who pays the judge's salary? Who's paying the judge's salary? It's the state of California. The state of California is complaining about your behavior. And then the state of California takes you in to the court of the state of California. So the state of California takes you into the state court in front of the state judge who's being paid on Friday by the state of California, the party who's complaining about your behavior. Now there's another guy in there called a prosecutor. This prosecutor is prosecuting you, and the prosecutor says, I'm here to put you away for the full term. You're a criminal, and I'm going to lay you away. Who's paying his salary? Ah, the complaining witness, the state of California. The state of California. Ah, and now we need a witness against you. Who is this witness against you? It's the policeman, the IRS agent. It's the employee of who? The state of California. Now the judge looks at you and says, Joe, maybe you don't understand the proceedings that are going on here. Maybe you're confused. And we just want to help. We just want to protect and serve. And so, at no cost to you whatsoever, we're going to appoint the public defender. Yes, sir? We're going to give you the public defender who's going to come in at no cost to you, which is a lie. And the public defender is being paid by who? Yeah, that's right, the state of California. Now, here you got the state of California brings you into the state's court in front of the state's judge, being prosecuted by the state's prosecutor. The witnesses against you are state agents who are being paid by the state, and then your defense lawyer is licensed by the state or is working and being paid by the state. And this is called a fair trial. Come on, Joe. If you're not brain dead, pay attention. This is not a fair trial, Joe. You need to get rid of that public defender. You need to come in here with some knowledge of the rules so that you can apply the rules. You know, there's 7 pleas you could make. There are 2 demurs you could make. There's an answer to the complaint you could make. You know, Joe, if you grow up and get wise in a hurry, you could probably go in there and win 84% of the time. Now, that's the purpose for the Gordon Law School. Now let's go back here to the soldier. Let me ask you a question. Do you think that the charge of being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, is a fair charge? Well, let me tell you, it's not only fair, it's true, accurate, and correct, because my name is George Gordon, and I am absent from Fort Lewis, and I don't have anybody's permission from Fort Lewis, Washington, to be right here today where I am. So if somebody came in here and charged me with being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, factually, that's true. Legally, that's false. Because there are 2 defenses, the minor premise and the major premise. The minor premise is George Gordon is absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, but the major premise is George Gordon doesn't have an enlistment contract with the United States Army, and this court doesn't have jurisdiction. Now, many people get mixed up over this jurisdiction thing, so let me hit it with you, or let me explain it to you just quickly. It is true that when you challenge jurisdiction, it is the burden then of the court or the prosecution to come in and prove jurisdiction. But, you know, walking into court, folding your arms, and saying, I challenge the jurisdiction of this court is not a jurisdictional challenge. Yeah, let me repeat that. Just announcing to the court that you're challenging the jurisdiction of the court is not a jurisdictional challenge, and the judge doesn't say a word. He just listens, and he's waiting for you to make the next statement. And I am prepared to offer witnesses, evidence, and testimony to prove that, and my first witness is. And then when you produce the witnesses, evidence, and testimony to prove that the court doesn't have jurisdiction, that is, that with a subpoena deuces tecum, you come in and demand that the prosecutor bring in the enlistment contract, and when he fails to do that, you move to dismiss in summary judgment because the state cannot prove their prima facie case, and that is that you're absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, because the first objective has to prove that you're a soldier in the Army. And nobody has to raise the issue of whether or not you're a soldier unless you raise it in your own defense. And that's the purpose for pleadings. And if you can't get your pleadings correct, you can't win the case. All right, now there's 28 things that you have to know in courtroom strategy and procedure. I've just kind of touched the tip of the iceberg here to give you an idea of what it is you have to do, what it is you're going to have to learn. 28 things. I covered a couple of them. Now, in order for you to learn more, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to my webpage. It's georgegordon.net, georgegordon.net, or you can hit com or org. It doesn't really make any difference. We got them all, but georgegordon.net. Click onto the email machine. That'll be my email address. Send us an email request for more information, and we'd be happy to give it to you. All right, I'm at the end of this disc. Let's change the disc over here, and we'll come back, and we'll take a look at another topic in the 8 schools here at the Gordon Law School. Maybe we'll take up private business next. That sounds like a good one. Private business. Stand by. All right, let's take up private business. What is business? Well, in the ordinary course of life and business, we call it commerce. In the Bible, we see the Canaanite traffickers, people who traffic, or people who deal in commerce. The Bible specifically prohibits commerce, but not trade. What's the difference between trade and commerce? Well, the Commerce Clause in the United States Constitution is an Achilles heel. It gives Congress the power to regulate commerce, trade, commerce, business, and industry that affects a public interest, can be regulated and controlled by government. And we see that in Wickard versus Filburn, cited at 317 U.S. 111. Wickard versus Filburn. Here's the story. A guy by the name of Filburn is a farmer in Indiana. 1938, during the Depression years, the government came along with a price support program for wheat. And they said, look, sign up and we'll pay 96 cents a bushel. Now you're going to get 56 cents a bushel. We'll give you 40 cents more if you'll... if you'll sign up for this price support regulatory program. And so Filburn signed up. Now, when he signed up, he got paid 96 cents a bushel, but he was limited to 20 acres. So he signed a contract, and he says, I agree that I'll grow no more than 20 acres of wheat, and you'll agree that you'll pay me 96 cents a bushel for every bushel that I harvest. There's the deal. Works in 39, 40, 41. But in 1941 or 42, Mr. Filburn planted 40 acres of wheat. 40. Twice as much as his allotment called for. Now, he took 20 acres, harvested it, and he sold it into commerce, and he took 20 acres and fed it to his turkeys. So he did not sell 40 acres of wheat into commerce. He took 20 acres and he used that for his turkeys. And when the government got wind of it, they prosecuted Mr. Filburn. He took the case clear to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court came back and said this. It is hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. Ah, so it tells us the first chain or the first link in the chain is commerce. So government can regulate that which it subsidizes. So when government gives you a benefit, government then sets down the rules. Well, then if you wanted to stay out of commerce, out from under the rulemaking body at Article 1, Section 8, the Commerce Clause, then you'd have to stay out of the contractual arrangement with government. That's private business. You see, Mr. Filburn could raise all the wheat in the world. He could have 100 acres, 1,000 acres, 1,000,000 acres, and take it out into the marketplace and sell it. But once he took the government benefit, he also took the government regulation. And you know, that's what everybody does when they get a business license. People get a business license, and then they complain about the regulatory schemes that government comes in and regulates that business by. You see, we didn't have regulation in business in 1900. And that's because the businessmen in 1900 didn't receive any government benefits. Now let's take a look at a second aspect of this called the adhesion contract. You know, people in the Patriot community have been battling statutes requiring specific performance for years and with wide and varying results. Now, one of the great generalizations about social history is the thesis of Sir Henry Maine that the history of progressive societies may be described as a movement from status to contract. We Americans, over the past century, have made a conscious move from the status of common law free man to the status of businessman. And in the process, we wanted to conduct business in commerce with commercial instruments. Well, when you do that, if you're going to do business in banks, buy stocks and bonds, have equitable interests, then those activities have to be regulated and controlled for the benefit of all of the participants, including the public at large. And that's, of course, the business of government. And so government comes in with the Securities and Exchange Commission and regulates stocks and stock sales, bonds and bond sales, and corporations and corporate business. And, of course, along comes the sales tax and the income tax and, of course, mandatory insurance and all kinds of regulations that regulate each and every aspect of these businesses, you know, like OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, IRS, and so on. Now, I operate a small private business here called the Gordon Law School. I don't have a business license. I don't deal in commercial paper. Tuition here at the school is paid in gold. We do business with people through private contract. We don't receive any government benefits, and because we don't participate in commerce, we don't have the regulations and the controls that ordinary businesses that do, in fact, deal in trade, commerce, business, and industry do have. Now, a contract of adhesion is summed up in an insurance policy. You see, an insurance policy is an adhesion contract. A driver's license is an adhesion contract. It is a contract that is imposed upon a vast host of vassals. And with the decline of the free enterprise system due to the innate trend of competitive capitalism towards monopoly, the meaning of contract over the past century has radically changed. Society, when granting freedom of contract, does not guarantee that all members of the community will be able to make use of contract to the same extent. On the contrary, the law, by protecting the unequal distribution of property, does nothing to prevent freedom of contract from becoming a one-sided privilege. Society, by proclaiming freedom of contract, guarantees that it will not interfere with the exercise of power by contract. Freedom of contract enables enterprisers to legislate by contract, and what's even more important, to legislate in a substantially authoritarian manner without using the appearance of authoritarian forms or means. Standard contracts in particular could thus become effective instruments in the hands of powerful industrial and commercial overlords, enabling them to impose a new feudal order of their own making upon a vast host of vassals. And the development of large-scale enterprise with its mass production and distribution inevitably led to a standardized mass contract. And the usefulness of these contracts was discovered in the banking, insurance, and transportation businesses, and their use spread to all other fields of large-scale enterprise, and into international as well as national trade, and into labor relations. And it's this uniformity of the terms of contracts which has become such an important factor in the precise calculation of risks, risks which are difficult to calculate may be eliminated altogether. So therefore, the standard clauses in insurance policies are the most striking examples of this attempt to select and control risks assumed under contracts. All right, now watch how adhesion contracts work. Now, an adhesion contract is a contract that is binding upon you that you don't know the terms and conditions of. So, for instance, you go into the bank to buy a house. The bank finances your house and requires as one of its terms and conditions that you buy homeowners insurance and fire insurance. And when you go down and you buy the insurance, you don't read that policy. You could, but you don't. So you don't know what the terms and conditions are. Well, one of the terms and conditions is that you're going to keep full coverage on the house. So as the house appreciates in value, you're supposed to increase the amount of insurance coverage. So if you have a fire in the house, like as not, it's going to be a $14,000 average kitchen fire. So you buy a $100,000 house, and you insure the house for $100,000, but over the years, the price of the house goes up to $200,000. Now you have a $14,000 kitchen fire. The insurance company pays you $7,000, 50% of the value of the house. And you sit there and say, that isn't fair, that isn't right. Well, that's what commerce is all about, and that's what adhesion contracts are all about, and that contract was written by the legal department of the insurance company and the banking industry. Like it or not, those are the terms and conditions of the adhesion contract. Now, let me show you the value of using gold and silver coin. When you come to school here, we will charge you gold coin. For instance, normal people would say they want $1,500 to go to school here. I would say to you that I want $225 or $90. $90 in gold coin paid to me in $20 double eagles. That's 4.5 ounces of gold. That's 4.5 ounces. People will ask me, well, how much does school cost? Well, it costs 9 ounces for the 2-week schools. And it costs 4.5 ounces for the 1-week schools. How many dollars, they want to know? Well, the answer is, it depends upon whether you use the $50 eagle or the $20 double eagle. And people say, no, no, I want to know how many dollars. Oh, you want to know how many Federal Reserve Note dollar units. Yes, yes. Well, if you went to buy a $20 double eagle today, it would probably cost you around $340. Therefore, you need approximately 4.5 of those to come to school here, which would be in the neighborhood of $1,500. Or you would need 4.5, and it'll be just maybe a little bit less than that. Let's say it's $325 to buy the eagles. Those are $50 denominated gold coins, and it'll cost you probably $100 less than that. Now, somebody says to me, well, how much if I just write you a check? Oh, we don't take checks. Well, why don't you take checks? Well, you see, if I were to take your check for $1,500, the minimum filing requirement for me is $7,200. So let's just go through that. That's $1,500, $30,000, $45,000, $6,000, $7,500. I would go over the $7,200 filing minimum with 5 students, wouldn't I? Ah, but if I take $225, you see, $225 divided into $7,200, or if I took $90 divided into $7,200, all of a sudden I could take 72 students, or about 40 students, or 5 students. Can you follow that? Now, I have to follow all the laws of the United States and all the laws of Missouri and all the laws of God, and I have to do all that at the same time. I can do that. I can't do it as a commercial merchant operating in trade, commerce, business, and industry with a business license trying to function under the Roman civil law, but I can practice the Mosaic law, the common law, and I can do that by using gold and silver coin, which is what I do. Now, some years back, I received a letter from the Missouri Bureau of Industrial Relations or Vocational Education. I think it was the Missouri Department or Bureau of Vocational Education. And they said to me, you're operating a law school and you don't have, we looked through our files and we can't find a license for you anywhere. So they sent me some literature and invited me to joining into the licensing scheme of the state of Missouri. So I wrote them a nice 9-page letter back and I said, gee, I really don't want to participate. You see, under Wickard versus Filburn, if I were to get a license, then I would be regulated and controlled by the state. Now, many people believe that all state or all business activity is regulated by the state. That's not true. No, no. See, under our Constitution, everybody in the country is free until he impairs his liberty to some degree by creating a license, a benefit, a permit. So I can't have the benefits that come from this licensing program. In other words, I can't get the 96 cents a bushel. I can't have that extra 40 cents a bushel. But I can grow as many acres of wheat as I desire. And I can charge my customers whatever the market price will bear. Or I can lower my prices. For instance, I could work for $1 an hour. You can't. You see, you're regulated by minimum wage laws. So while you have to be paid $5 an hour, I could work for one silver dollar an hour, which is worth $7 an hour, you see, in Federal Reserve notes. Or I could work for $5 an hour, which is minimum wage, paid to me in gold coin, which has a commercial trade value out in the marketplace of about 40 Federal Reserve Note dollars. And that's because of the Coinage Act of 1964, which was codified in Title 31, Section 5101 through 5112 of the U.S. Code. Why don't we take a look at that? We'll flip over here to 5101. Title 31, the United States money is expressed in dollars, dimes, and tenths, cents or hundredths, mills or thousandths, and a dime is a tenth of a dollar, a cent is a hundredth of a dollar, and a mill is a thousandth of a dollar. That's Title 31, Section 5101. Now, in Section 5102, the standard troy pound of the National Bureau of Standards of the Department of Commerce shall be the standard used to ensure that the weight of the United States coins conforms to specifications in Section 5112 of this title. And 5103 gives us a little more information and tells us that United States coins and currency, including Federal Reserve notes and circulating notes of Federal Reserve banks and national banks, are legal tender for all debts, public charges, taxes, and dues. Foreign gold or silver coins are not legal tender for debts. So Congress comes along and says, okay, now, Mr. Gordon, if you would like to, you can take a $20 double eagle and you can pay your property taxes with that. And I have to go in and pay, if I wanted to buy one of those, 340 Federal Reserve notes. So I could go in and pay my taxes with 340 Federal Reserve notes, or I could convert that to one $20 double eagle, and I would get $20 worth of tax credit for 1 ounce of gold. Isn't that just special? Now, a lot of times people look at me and they say, God, you're stupid. Why, you're just a dum-dum. Why, you don't have any brains at all. And that's why people with more intelligence than I have deal in commercial paper, stocks and bonds, and they buy Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing and fools like me. We're not smart enough to do business in trade, commerce, business, and industry, and we miss out on all of the profit and gain that comes from all of these neat activities in the stock market and bonds and so on. But as a little trade-off over here, when I take this $20 double eagle from my student, he goes out and he pays $340 and he gets that $20 double eagle. So I charge him four and a half of those, and I can get 360 of those. Just try it. Just divide 20 into $7,200, the minimum filing requirement, and you'll get 360. Now, if I take one of those $20 double eagles down to my gold broker and I say, Charlie, I would like you to trade this in for me. I'd like to give you this $20 gold piece. It's a real neat one. And how many Federal Reserve notes will you give me? And he won't give me 340, but he'll give me about 320 or 315. And then somebody says, my God, Gordon, you are dumb. Now, look, you know, you'd be better off if you just charged $1,500 each time. Well, I discovered years ago that when I pay $1,500 or I collect $1,500, then I have to pay an income tax. And if I do very many of those transactions in a year's time, it could cost me as much as $42,000 in income tax and another $15,000 in Social Security taxes, which is around, $57,000 out of my $100,000 income, which only leaves me with about $43,000. So one day I woke up and I said, my God, what would happen if I just took the $20 double eagle, gave you credit at it for 340 Federal Reserve notes, charged you 4.5 ounces, took in $90, divided that into 7,200, I could get 360 of those. 360 $20 double eagles has the purchasing power of $117,000 in Federal Reserve notes. And since it's under $7,200, there is no tax return and $0 of taxes. And then, since I've rescinded my Social Security account, and I don't participate in Social Security, and don't participate under Wickard versus Filburn in commerce, I don't have to pay that Social Security tax. Of course, then when I get to be an old man, I'll starve to death because I won't have any way to make a living, and I'll be old and full of years, and you see, I won't have any Social Security, and that's where I'm at right now. You see, in my high school class, all of my high school friends and neighbors and relatives, see, they all are retired now on Social Security, living their lives happily ever after on the dole, and George Gordon has no Social Security, so I have to keep working. I can't retire, ever. I know it's terrible, but that's the trade-off that you make. So I get $117,000 a year in purchasing power under that $7,200. Can you follow that? Now, if I take $50 double eagles, I get about $40,000 worth of purchasing power. So like I said, what goes around comes around. And I make it a point to participate in gold coin and silver coin so that I don't have to pay that tax. Flip over here to 5112, and I'll show you the law. Gold coins is in 5112A, and then down here in silver dollars is 5112E. Now take a look at G. This is 5112G. For purposes of section 5132A1 of this title, all coins minted under subsection E of this section shall be considered to be numismatic items. So the coins that I deal in are called numismatic coins. Numismatic. That means that the people's fear, you know, that they're going to confiscate your gold. That's fine. Remember they said they don't confiscate your gold if it's numismatic? Well, Congress was very nice to us, and they gave us this numismatic clause in 5112G. And then legal tender, look at this, H, 5112H, the coins issued under this title shall be legal tender as provided in section 5103 of Title 31 of the U.S. Code. So I've got numismatic coins, legal tender, and They are legal tender for all debts, public and private. So I can take those in at face value, and I can spend them at face value. And when I spend them at face value, I get $117,000 worth of purchasing power for $7,200. So when God told us to use just weights and balances, you'll see that in Leviticus 19:35 and 36. He wasn't whistling Dixie through a straw hat. Furthermore, the laws of the United States always comport perfectly with the laws of the Bible. You'll never find the United States government or any state government or any city or municipality, county, or other political subdivision that violates the law of God. So if you can practice the Mosaic law and do that to perfection, you can also comply with all the laws of the United States, because we have a clause in our Constitution, First Amendment, called the Free Exercise Clause. All right, now, if you would like to learn more about how to do private business so that you can comply with the income tax laws and all the rest of the laws of the country, call me at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or just go to my webpage, georgegordon.com. That's georgegordon.com. Click on to the email and send me an email request. That's all there is to it. Now let's take up a second topic over here called family law. All right, here we go again. We're on marriage is a licensed business. And anytime you get a license, you're engaged in some kind of an illegal activity, because a license by definition is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. So what is family law all about? Well, family law is that body of law that is regulated under the marriage license. And there are courts that just deal with family law. We call them divorce courts, but they're typically called family courts. And they deal with such things as the guardian-ward relationship, parents, patre, custody standards, custody, marriage, divorce, separation, alimony, child support. But there are literally thousands of laws that regulate this industry called marriage. For instance, you have to have your children immunized in order to send them to public school. They have to be sent to public school because we have compulsory education laws. And these laws are enacted by the legislature in conformance to, or a part of, or as a part of the marriage business. There was a time in marriage in America when we didn't have marriage licenses. Prior to 1876, when Illinois became the first state to start issuing marriage licenses on a large scale, general application for marriage licenses, even as far back as 1900, you know, just 25 years later, marriage licenses were not common. But by 1920, they were common. By 1940, they're practically universal. Today, if somebody is married without a marriage license, people kind of look at them with tongue in cheek and say, oh my God, that's a common law marriage. Or they're just living together, or they're shacked up, or they don't have a real marriage. Well, going back in time, did we have real marriages when Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were running around on the planet, or were all of their marriages just funny marriages and their children were all bastards because, after all, they weren't married? Where would Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Daniel, or any of those people have gone to get a marriage license? Well, they would have gone to the king. They'd have gone to the state. Marriage licenses aren't something new. They're new in Anglo-Saxon administration, but they're not new in pagan mythology, ideology, government, politics, or religion. You know, the ancient Babylonians and the Egyptians and Sumerians all went to the king to get permission to marry, because marriage is a business. It's a family business, to be sure, but it's a business. And today, it's big business, and it's regulated by the state. Now, this marriage is a three-party limited general partnership. That is, the boy, the girl, and the state. It's by, for, and among, and between all three of these parties. and the marriage license is proof of that contract. A common law marriage is a two-party contract between the boy and the girl. It's by, for, among, and between the two parties. There may be or there may not be a formal written instrument as proof of the contract. The agreement to contract is by penetration, that's consensual sexual intercourse, and agreement. It is not universally recognized, and where it is recognized, such as in Texas, the states assume jurisdiction by way of birth certificates. And when it's recognized by the state, there is very little difference between a common law marriage and a civil law marriage. Now, a patriarchal marriage, which comes from the scripture, is a two-party contract between the boy and the girl's father. The female is not a contracting party. The contract is for a limited purpose, and that is of transferring guardianship of the female from the father to the husband. The girl's father gives away his daughter in a public ceremony. The contract terminates upon consummation. The consummation is the proof of the marriage. And upon consummation, the boy accepts all of the liabilities of the girl's father. And under Hebrew law, the females must be taken care of from the cradle to the grave. So the female is a liability which is transferred to the husband. The female is the object of the contract, not a contracting party. Kind of a wild new concept, isn't it? Now, there are various standards for custody. And custody is predicated upon the doctrine of parens patre. So let's take a look at who owns this child. So let me make this statement. No female on planet Earth in the entire history of mankind has ever owned a child. Let me repeat that. No female on this planet has ever owned a child. No female on this planet's ever going to own a child. And that's because fathers can own children and states can own children. That is, the king can own your child, mother, or your husband can own your child, but you can't. Now, in America today, neither the father or mother own the child. The state owns the child, and it comes under the doctrine of parens patre. Now, the origin of the doctrine of parens patre in the law can be traced to medieval and late medieval English chancery courts, where it played an important role in the maintaining of the structure of feudalism. Chancery, as an agent of the monarchy, had a duty to assure the orderly transfer of feudal duties from one generation to another, and to ensure that there would be someone available to perform these duties, and the concept of parens patre was usually invoked in connection with problems of property or guardianship. Now, in some of the colonial statutes, we can see the beginnings of the idea that children are to be protected not only from poverty, but also from parents who are undeserving. Now, who determines whether a parent is undeserving? Well, Lord Redesdale maintained that parents have rights to their children only as a privilege granted by the state, and the state delegates control over children to their parents as a trust, and that it does so because parents usually discharge this trust faithfully on behalf of their children. Again, who decides who an unfit parent is? Oh, that's done by the state. Now, the right of parental control is a natural but not an unalienable one, and in the trust referred to by Lord Redesdale, the settlor, or the creator of the trust, is the state. The trustee is presumably the child's natural parents, and the beneficiary of the trust, or the sesticui trust, is called the minor child. The fiduciary relationship does not rule out the satisfaction of interests that parents have as individuals, but they may not criticize these standards on the grounds that the parents are a specific child's parents and that they know what is best for their own child. You know, mothers and daddies, the concept that you know what's best for your child resides with the state, not with you. And the reason that the state comes in and determines these kinds of facts is because you have a marriage license in which you invited the state into your marriage as a third party. That is, the boy, the girl, and the state. So you have a three-party limited general partnership in which the state is a one-third party and has a one-third property right or interest in the profits that are generated by the family, by the marriage. So when mom and dad get married with a state marriage license, and then mom and dad produce children, motorcycles, snow machines, condominiums, houses, businesses, property. When dad dies, mama says, oh, goody, I get all the toys. And the state comes in and says, oh no, mommy, buy me out. So what does buy me out mean? It means pay the inheritance tax, mommy. Because, you see, there's three of us involved in this partnership, and now the partnership has been dissolved by the death or by the divorce of one of the parties. Therefore, pay me. So the state comes in and regulates the custody, for which there are 12 custody standards. You see, parens patriae is created by the state, and then the state comes up and says, okay, now we're going to develop these standards by which the state will determine custody. Isn't that just real special? I knew you'd love it. Now, when we talk about custody, then, we're talking about 12 standards that the state develops to make a determination as to who should have this child. Who should have custody of the child, the mother or the father. Now, when the state comes in and makes that determination, they make it in the child's best interest. Or do they make it in the state's best interest and call it the child's best interest because it sounds better for public relations? In any event, the following is a list of the 12 items a family court judge will look for when determining a person's fitness to have physical and or legal custody of a minor child. These are not put in any specific order, as each court, indeed each judge, will weigh these differently. And also some courts and or judges will have additional items which they may use. However, we know of no family court that doesn't start with these 12 items. Number one is called the moral character. Usually the judge will consider the moral character of all those seeking custody as well as any individuals with whom they live. Two, financial ability. This is used to determine a party's ability to provide a financially stable environment. During divorces, the wife's financial ability is based on, or at least in part, just how much money can she expect to be paid by her husband in alimony and child support. So when this issue comes up, like financial ability, you know, if you stop and think about it for a moment, you know, men actually have the better financial ability to support the child than do mothers. Ah, well then why is it that mothers get custody 96.5% of the time and fathers 3.5% of the time? Well, that's because the state is really the father, and the father is a eunuch, and the state comes in and says, here's who I want to raise my child. And so the state, who owns the child by way of the birth certificate, had a one-third interest with the marriage license, and when you got the birth certificate, you and your wife gave 100% of the child to the state. And you did that for a benefit. Remember? Under Wickard versus Filburn, you wanted to be able to collect food stamps, welfare, and send your child to free public school, free public education. That's just three of the many benefits that you receive from the state as a partner with the state in your family business. Isn't that real neat? So now the state comes in under Wickard versus Filburn, and they regulate the terms and conditions of this marriage. And they regulate it Because after all, they own it, don't they? Number 3, parental affection. Number 4, child rearing skills. Number 5, child training skills. Number 6, the best interests of the child. And then, the ability to provide the necessities of life. This goes beyond mere financial ability to cover those items which cannot be quantified financially. A person with lots of money who can't be bothered to buy good shoes for their child may pass the financial ability test but fail this one. Formal education. In contested issues of custody, the general rule is that all other items being equal, the more educated a party is, the better their chances of keeping or getting custody. So those of you that have a PhD, or you have a master's degree, or you have a college degree, just picture this, Daddy. You've got a master's degree in business administration, you're financially able, and the mother, in this case, maybe is a high school graduate or a high school dropout, and there's a contested issue over custody, and that is you want custody of the child. Hey, listen. All things being equal, you got a better shot at getting custody than does the mother. And I don't care, from my point of view here at the law school, whether you're male or female. Everybody has a constitutional right to the child. That's right, a constitutional right to that child. That means that you fathers have a 50-50 shot at getting the child if you only knew how. And what about child support? Oh, that's a big issue. I get asked that quite often. Well, child support is a requirement both of the civil law and the common law. It goes clear back to Moses at Mount Sinai. You have a duty to support your child there, daddies. Well, if you're going to support your child, why don't you take custody of your child? And then, of course, there's playmates, and then the history of child abuse. So if you're a child abuser over here, you don't have a very good chance of coming out of here with the child. Or if you have a history of child neglect, now that'll work against you. All right, now, when it comes to custody, that is the custody item itself, then who is it who's entitled to taking custody, or what determines custody, for instance, in Pennsylvania? Well, in making an award of custody between parents, the court must consider the best interests of the children. Overnight visitation is called partial custody. Any custody order is reviewable upon any change of circumstances. You know, you could call up a new custody hearing 12 times a year. If there's 12 changes in custody or in the circumstances of custody, in addition to that, you can call it up once per year for the entire life of the child until the child reaches 18. So this custody is reviewable every year, daddies. And a child's desires with regard to custody and parental custody are given more weight as the child gets older. Until age 12, such desires have very little weight. Third parties can obtain custody very rarely. Grandparents have a right to visitation that is statutorily guaranteed in some situations, and particularly where their child, the parent of their grandchildren, has died or is separated from the grandchildren's other parent. Did you know that you grandparents also have rights in many states, or in most states, as a matter of fact? And there are such things as contempt of a custody order. You know, if your spouse is in contempt of a custody order, you can have the custody order modified and have parental custody terminated. Termination of parental rights. And then grandparents and custodial rights come into play. And the custody generally. You know, custody embraces the sum of parental rights with respect to the rearing of a child, including his care. And it includes the right to the child's services and earnings, and the right to direct his activities and to make decisions regarding his care and control, education, health, and religion. The legal custody of a minor is in the parent's or the surviving parent, unless there's been a court adjudication awarding custody to a third person. Now let's take a look at the guardian-ward relationship. You know, there's a guardian-ward relationship that comes into play with the state, the mommy, and the daddy. And this guardian-ward relationship is called a trust relationship. Listen to this. Did you know that a guardianship is a trust relation of the most sacred character? Sacred, sacred. Hey, that's kind of religious, isn't it? In which one person who is called a guardian acts for another called the ward, whom the law regards as incapable of managing his own affairs. Now, you know, when custody is taken away from you, whether you're a mother or a father, do you know that the state then is acting in a guardian-ward relationship between you and the state and is taking the guardianship away from you and the child, or the control of the child away from you, in a guardian-ward relationship? They view you as being a ward of the state. Have you ever thought of yourself as being a ward, incapable of managing your own affairs, incapable of raising or rearing your own child? Well, that's what it boils down to. Now, a curator is a guardian appointed by the court to control property of a minor. He's not a guardian of the person, and in some jurisdictions, a conservator may be appointed. He has the same powers and obligations as a guardian so far as they relate to the property of the ward, so that in effect, he is a guardian of the estate. Now, the purpose of statutes relating to guardianship is to safeguard the rights and interests of minors and incompetent persons, and the court should be vigilant to see that the rights of such persons are properly protected. The court having jurisdiction of a guardianship matter is said to be the superior guardian, while the guardian himself is deemed to be an officer of the court. So what you do is you go out and get a marriage license and create a three-party limited general partnership. Then you have children. As a member of the three-party limited general partnership, the state is the superior partner and gives custody to mommy and daddy, or, in the event of a divorce of mommy and daddy, gives custody to one of the surviving parents as it deems best in the child's best interest. That's a guardian-ward relationship in which, when you get a marriage license and have a child, you become the state's babysitter over the state's child, and you can raise the state's child in the state's school, educate the state the child in the state's humanist religion. And if you decide that you don't want to do any of the above, then you're subject to having new babysitters appointed. That's called termination of parental rights. About 2.5 million children a year are taken out of their homes and placed in foster care because the state is dissatisfied with mommy and daddy and wants to change babysitter. So if you're a mother or a father and you have children with a marriage license and a birth certificate, you, as a matter of law, are an officer of the court, a guardian over the child. And your guardianship over the child is subject to replacement by a new babysitter if the state decides that they're not satisfied with your guardianship. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, the appointment of a conservator works like this. In several states, statutes authorize a person who, although of sound mind, when he believes that he's incapable of managing his own estate or of caring for his own property, he may apply for, request, or simply consent to the appointment of a conservator or a guardian of his estate or of his person or both, and that's the marriage license, and who, when appointed, possesses over the estate substantially the same powers and is subject in regard thereto to substantially the same duties as a guardian of an incompetent. So when you get a marriage license, you declare yourself to be incompetent, unable to manage a family. I mean, after all, you may become unemployed one of these days, and you won't be able to feed, clothe, and house your family, and so therefore, you're going to need the benefits of the state, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, or something of the like. You want to avail yourself of the safety net, do you not? All Americans do. Most Americans have. Now, what would happen if you decided that you would like to determine whether or not your child has immunization? How would it be if you decided on your child's school? Well, did you know that every state in the union makes provisions for an exemption to immunization, save for two, Mississippi and West Virginia, and homeschool by all 50 states, and that you can educate your child at home, or in a parochial school, or in public school, and that you can choose if you just knew how to use the family law of your state to accomplish that goal. Same thing is true with immunization. You see, immunization violates the scripture. And any time that there is a law that violates the scripture, then God comes in and creates a waiver for those people who want to obey God and keep His commandments. So, except for Mississippi and West Virginia, which you'll have to get a court order. So in school, I'll teach you how to get a court order. Or if you're in Missouri, there's a waiver. And if you're in California, you can object on just personal moral grounds. Just personal moral grounds. And there's an objection. And if you'll put in your objection, take the waiver, you can avoid or prohibit or prevent immunization or public school. Now remember, this comes under Wickard versus Filburn. The government regulates and controls that which it subsidizes. What would happen if you wanted to get married and you didn't want any government subsidies? Hey, did you know that you could have a baby, you could have a marriage, and you can function in American society as a common law free man without government intervention? That's a wild new concept that we make available and explain in detail here in the Family Law School. Family Law. For more information, just call the school. That's 317-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to my webpage. It's georgegordon.com. That's georgegordon.com. Click onto the email and send me an email request, and we'll give you more information about family law. All right, let's take a break here, and we'll come back and take up the next subject, which will be the Civil Rights Act, Title 42, Section 1983. All right, let's take a look here at civil rights. Civil rights is an offensive action. It's where we're not here to defend, we're here to offend. We're here to sue, to become a plaintiff, to go into court and to seek a redress for a grievance, a redress for a right. If you've been falsely arrested or falsely imprisoned or maliciously prosecuted, typically it occurs in such areas of civil rights as housing. You may go into the Holiday Inn and they refuse to give you a room unless you got a driver's license, or maybe you wanted to rent a house and they wouldn't rent you a house because you were black. We typically think of civil rights as being concerned with race and race relations, when in reality it covers just about everything, including race and race relations. But it's there for everybody, whether you're black or white or Indian or whatever it happens to be. Any time that a government institution, agency, or agent wrongs you, commits a tort against you, deprives you of some right, privilege, or immunity that you're entitled to, that's a crime. Now, when we take a look at crimes committed in America, there are about 14 million crimes committed against us every year by criminals. To combat that, we hire police and FBI, and we build prisons and jails, and we hire jailers and prison guards to protect us from these criminals. In the process of doing that, the police commit 14,600,000 crimes. Now, of the 14 million crimes that are committed against us by criminals, we don't have to pay the criminals any extra for committing a crime against us, like robbing us, burglarizing our houses, or causing us a damage. But when the police commit 14,600,000 crimes against us every year, we have to pay them their salaries to commit those crimes against us. So the government comes along under the Civil Rights Act of 1868 and enacted a provision which is called Title 42, Section 1983, to prohibit or to give us, it actually won't prohibit it, but it will give you a remedy so that when you're locked up for a month or two, and you weren't supposed to be locked up, you were innocent, you didn't do this, then you get compensated. Now, typically for false arrest, the general rule of thumb is $1,000 a day. So if you got arrested and you spent 30 days in jail, you should get $30,000. Well, there is a special act or action called the Civil Rights Act or the Civil Rights Action that you go to in order to achieve that goal. Now, the purpose behind the Civil Rights Act is to give the police and cities a guide to go by and an incentive to follow the Constitution and don't commit crimes against citizens. Now, that's what it's designed for. It works about 26% of the time. That is, of all of the people who file an action, 26 will be successful and 74 will fail. It's the best percentage of all litigation that goes into courts or federal courts in the percentage of those that we receive monetary awards for. Let me tell you a story of a lady up in Ketchikan, Alaska. She parked her car a number of times and didn't put money in the meter and got a number of parking tickets. Now, that's against the law to park your car and not put money in the meter. And she was given a number of tickets that she didn't pay. Now, if you get a ticket and you don't pay the ticket, that's against the law, and you're not supposed to do that. So the police, in order to enforce this law, arrested her and put her in jail. Now, when the police arrested this lady and put her in jail because she didn't pay the parking tickets, that was a crime. That's against the law. You see, in Alaska, it's against the law to lock somebody up because he doesn't pay a parking ticket. But they did that. They locked her up. They arrested her and jailed her, and that broke the law. Now, two wrongs don't make a right. So she came to class down here and went through the civil rights class. She went up there and she sued them under the Civil Rights Act. And then she settled for what's known as a nuisance value settlement from Northern Adjusters, and she collected $8,000. She went to the city hall to make her closing, and she took the check for $8,000, put it in her shirt pocket, and she walked out of the city hall and got into her car and drove down the street. Now, she doesn't have a driver's license. Now, it's against the law to drive a car without a driver's license. And so the police, knowing that she had just burned them for $8,000 and they were a little ticked off at her, knew that it was against the law to drive a car without a driver's license, and furthermore knew she didn't have a driver's license and she was driving a car. So she was arrested and jailed for driving without a driver's license. Now, the law requires that when you arrest and jail a female, you must have a female guard or a female prison guard or jailer. And in Ketchikan, they didn't have that. Now, by arresting her and jailing her and then locking her up without a female jailer is against the law. So, the police, not knowing quite how to handle this, being men, of course, they gave her her jail suit, told her to go into the dressing room, which, by the way, doesn't have any doors on it, but there's a partition, and it separated the shower and the dressing room from the booking area of the jail, and they told her to go in there and put on the jail suit, so she went in and sat down. And then after a little while, the jailer said, "Are you ready?" And she said, "No, I'm not, and don't you come in here either." And then some more time passed by, and the two jail guards asked, "Well, are you ready?" And she said, "No, and don't you come in here." Well, after this went on for three or four or five times, the jail guards, not knowing quite what to do, said, "Well, we're coming in, and you better be ready. Ready or not, here we come in." And so they came in, and here she was sitting in her street clothes, and she hadn't put on the orange jail suit, and they were very upset, which jailers are not supposed to get upset now, because it's a part of your job description now, you jailers. But not knowing what else to do, they each one, on each side, grabbed a hold of her arms. This is called an assault. And went to pick her up. I don't know exactly what they had in mind when they picked her up out of the chair that she was sitting in. But she screamed, "No, no, don't rape me, don't rape me," as she broke away from them and she escaped. And she was now on the floor, and she crawled out from behind the partition into the jail booking room where there were three or four or five other witnesses who could see that her blouse was ripped open, the buttons ripped off, her bra was torn, and her breasts were hanging out. This is called an assault and an attempted rape. That's against the law. And she settled that claim for $12,000 in another nuisance value case, in which, after that second settlement, she never had any further problems with the police or the political authorities in Ketchikan, Alaska. This is called making a meaningful political and social change, and this is what occurred in Montgomery, Alabama, with Rosa Parks. You see, they had a law in the books that said blacks have to ride the back of the bus. And this Rosa Parks, in conjunction with the ACLU and the NAACP, two civil rights organizations seeking to make meaningful political and social change in a local area, set about to do so by enlisting Rosa Parks' help. And she got on the bus, sat down on the front of the bus. She was black and broke the law. It was against the law to ride the front of the bus and be black at the same time. She was arrested and jailed. As this case wound its way up through the judicial system to the United States Supreme Court, the Supreme Court said, you know, that law in Mississippi is illegal and unlawful. Under the rational basis test, that law has no basis whatsoever in law, and we want to change that law. So they struck it down as being unconstitutional. And this is the way you make meaningful political and social change at the local level, and at the same time collect monetary damages for having been falsely arrested, falsely prosecuted, and abused. And oftentimes the police, they abuse people, they beat them up. And that is against the law. And what I'm pointing out here to you boys and girls is that, you see, the law applies to the police as well as it applies to us. The problem is, the police will enforce the law against you, the citizen, but the police will not enforce the law against another policeman. If we have the same problem with lawyers. You see, lawyers will sue anybody. If it wiggles, moves, or squirms, a lawyer will sue it, all except another lawyer who commits malpractice. Now, you can't find a lawyer to sue a lawyer for malpractice, but you can find a lawyer to sue a doctor for malpractice. Oh, well, you know, sometimes you can't get a level playing field, but you know, as a pro se litigant, you can help to level the playing field. Now, I had a student one time by the name of Rick. Rick was jailed for contempt of court. Now, it's against the law to commit contempt of court. So, while he was in jail, I set about to help Rick in jail, so I paid his rent, and I paid his utilities, and paid him $500 a month to stay in jail as long as possible. So, he didn't purge himself of the contempt, and he stayed in the Ada County Jail for 5 months. This is called a civil rights sting. What we're trying to do here is to find out whether the police are breaking the law. The people who are best equipped to determine if the police are abusing or violating the law are the citizens who the police are violating their rights. So, we have Rick in the county jail. Now, Rick is writing administrative demands and keeping a daily log or journal. Some people call these diaries. And for 5 months, he made demands based upon federal standards for prisons and jails, kind of like Rosa Parks riding the front of the bus. And what he was trying to do was to identify any one of 353 laws being violated by the police or the jailers in the Ada County Jail. In 5 months, he couldn't find a single one. Not a one. Every time he wrote an administrative demand and he said, the law requires that you do this, they did it. And every time he wrote an administrative demand and said, I want this because the law provides for it, they gave it to him. And this went on for 5 months, and I said, well, after about $8,000, that's enough. Rick, you can purge yourself of the contempt and you can come out. Now, in the 2 years prior to Rick's incarceration for 5 months, The police were very naughty people, and they violated the rights of many, many citizens who had availed themselves of the services of the Ada County Jail. For instance, there was a young boy who was incarcerated. He was 17 years old, and he was put over in the adult section of the jail. Now, that's against the law. It's against the law to incarcerate a juvenile in the adult section. Unfortunately, the young boy was killed. And as a result of that, his mother sued the jail for wrongful death and collected $3.5 million. And at the same time this was going on, George Gordon and other concerned citizens were also suing the jail and the jail personnel, along with other concerned citizens who didn't have anything to do with George Gordon, but they were just suing the jail because the jail was breaking the law, which is what citizens are supposed to do. You see, we're supposed to sue those that are in positions of authority who break the law. In the process of doing this, the insurance company noted that Boise City and Ada County were 35% above the national average. So the nice people at the insurance company came into the jail and suggested to them that they ought to change their practices, because if they did not, they were going to cancel their policy and double their premiums. The people at the jail did not change, did not reform themselves, and the insurance company canceled their policy. So in 1983, the Ada County Sheriff's Department jail, the city of Boise, was paying $3.2 million for insurance coverage. Well, Idaho requires that you have insurance, so they had to go into the marketplace and get an assigned risk policy from another company, and they doubled their premiums to $7 million. Well, that company, over a period of 1 year, also came into the jail and made numerous suggestions as to how they might change the operation of the jail and bring their 35% rate of lawsuits down to somewhere around the national average. Again, the people in the jail were naughty, and they did not take the good insurance company's advice. And at the end of the second year, that insurance company canceled their insurance. And the law, remember, requires that they go back into the marketplace and get insurance. And the third company raised their rates to $14 million. So their rates went from $3 million to $14 million in 24 months. Then, when that insurance company came in and made good suggestions about how the jail might change its ways, they took the advice, and when our student Rick Mitchell was in the jail, they did not violate his rights even once. Oh, and by the way, there were other people that were associated with me and Barrister Zinn who also collected monetary damages in addition to their insurance going up by $3, $7, and $14 million. The people who were locked up and whose rights were violated also collected monetary damages. You know, that happened in Chicago. You know, in Chicago, they were arresting women and jailing them. What they did was they instructed the policeman, if you see a woman alone driving an automobile, and you're a policeman, you pull your cruiser up behind her and you follow her, looking for a crime. You check her license plate and make sure that it isn't expired. And then you watch her, and as you follow her, and she knows that you're a cop following her, she'll get nervous. And then when she changes lanes, she'll forget to give a signal. Or when she stops at a stop sign, you'll see that one of her stoplights is burned out. And that'll give you probable cause to make a stop. Now, that was a naughty thing to do. And it's called a fishing expedition, and that's against the law. And the police are not supposed to do that. And not only did the police do it, they were instructed to do it by their political supervisors, the mayor and the city council and the chief of police. Well, there was a doctor who was arrested, and she was strip searched. And that's exactly what this what this scam called for. You see, when you stop this lady and you have probable cause, you walk up and then you ask her for a driver's license, registration, proof of insurance, her safety sticker, and then you've got a chance to look in the car, and if you see a gun or you see cocaine or you see anything that might be contraband, that'll give you grounds to arrest her. And no woman will go to jail and stay in jail if she can bail herself out, and we'll take credit cards, checks. And so with this liberal policy of commerce in the jail, they would now take credit cards and checks as well as cash and bail bonds, and that means that the county made a lot of interest-free loans. That was against the law. You see, the only purpose for bail is to guarantee your appearance in court, not to force people to make interest-free loans. So, over a period of years, 25 years, this practice went on, and many, many people's rights were violated. One federal judge said that he thought more than 500,000 women's rights were violated. That was 500,000 crimes committed by the police in Chicago against the citizens of Chicago. That was bad. That was against the law. You see, that was naughty. They weren't supposed to do that, but they did. So one doctor, and it takes somebody like this, a doctor, went ahead and sued. And when this case was finally adjudicated, she collected $112,000. That's right, $112,000, because she was falsely arrested, jailed, and strip searched using this program. Now, maybe what she did, maybe she was driving her car and her stoplights weren't working, and maybe she was speeding, and maybe she was breaking the law. But you see, it's against the law for the policeman to break the law. Yeah, that's right. And if the policeman acts under color of law, that is, if he pretends that he's using the law in order to enforce the law, and he does that with the express purpose of breaking the law so that he can violate your rights and commit a crime against you, that's actionable, and we need to take action. And the only people that can do that are called citizens, because the police don't police the police. The police police citizens, and the citizen police the police. That's why George Gordon is a civil rights investigator. And I would like to enlist you in the cause of civil rights. Because, you see, it's not a racial thing, it's a law and order thing. And the president, Bill Clinton, he said, we need 100,000 more policemen out on the streets so that we can control and we can detect and we can punish crimes committed by citizens. Well, the number of crimes committed by criminals against us citizens are about 14 million a year, and the number of crimes committed by the police against citizens is another 14 million. I say we need another 100,000 citizens, people just like you, who are trained and can identify crime and can gather names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, and then come into court as a pro se litigant and press those charges, present those claims, and punish those wicked policemen who violate the law. Yeah, that's right. Policemen that break the law are criminals. And there's approximately 14 million of those crimes being committed every year. And we need to stop it. Crime should be stopped wherever it raises its ugly head. Whether it's in the Ramparts Division of the Los Angeles Police Department, where the police have violated the rights of people, even to the extent of taking evidence and coming into court with phony evidence to convict people who were innocent and hadn't done the crime. Yeah, that's right. That's malicious prosecution. And those crimes ought to be exposed and punished. Now, you know, you can stay out of a whole lot more trouble than you can get yourself out of, and I would like to suggest my civil rights class to teach you how to stay out of trouble. And this is a school for people who want to stay out of jail. Yeah, that sounds kind of peculiar. But if you want to stay out of trouble, you need to know the law and how to use the law. You know, I stay out of more trouble than I can get myself out of, but from time to time, when trouble overtakes you, people will call me at the law school and they'll say, "Oh, Mr. Gordon, it's so good to talk to you. My son Bobby has been arrested and jailed on a drug charge, and I can't get in to see him, and we can't get him out of jail, and we don't know what to do." All right, so let me explain it. When you get into trouble, you need a lawyer. You see, this is a law school. This is not a law firm. We don't deal with people when they get into trouble. We deal with people before they get into trouble and teach them how to stay out of trouble, how to stay out of jail, how to stay out of the kinds of problems that people are involved in every day, like, I didn't pay my child support, and now they're going to arrest me and jail me, or they're going to take my children away from me, or. Now, if you would like to learn how to do just that, stay out of trouble, then Civil Rights is the class for you. Now, the number to call is 417-273-4967. Again, that's the Gordon Law School, area code 417-273-4967. Or you can go to the webpage. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And click onto my email machine and send me an email request and tell me that you'd like to learn more about, or you'd like to have us tell you more about, this thing called the Civil Rights Act. When you want to make meaningful political and social change in your town, like we did in Boise, Idaho, you can do it. And you can do it by yourself. You don't need to vote for Bill Clinton or anybody else. All right, let's take a break here. We'll come back, and I've got three more lessons, their classes to take up. Let's take a look at subsistence and survival, how to make $100,000 on 25 acres or less, and the Mosaic Law School, coming up on Disc 3. Stand by. All right, here we go. We're talking about subsistence and survival. And I'm George Gordon. This is my general law CD disc. And when we talk about subsistence and survival, most people think in terms of an Uzi submachine gun, camouflage clothes, and thousands of rounds of bullets. I think that the modern concept in most patriots' minds is out of sync with reality. You know, in 1979, I received a copy of a massive document commissioned by the Club of Rome and written by Cyrus Vance 3 days after the president, James Earl Carter, accepted it as official U.S. policy. Now, at that time, Global 2000 was unknown outside of the Committee of 300 and carefully chosen officials inside the United States government. So I could justly claim to be the first private person to reveal in my World Intelligence Review the existence and content of this unbelievable blueprint for genocide on a global scale. And I say unbelievable because at first sight it sounds like something from the pages of Dr. Moreau, almost as unbelievable as the involvement of the British royal family in the drug trade. Now that's the opening paragraph of Global 2000, a blueprint for global genocide. It's written by John Coleman, and it's a part of my subsistence and survival school because there are 64 life-threatening problems that we face that are directly attributable to the pages of the Bible. I know the Bible's kind of a crazy book to be bringing into subsistence and survival. Most people think of terrorism and government's protections, and we're going to go to the airport and we're going to get searched real good to protect us from these terrorists. But you know, terrorism doesn't really pose much of a threat. That's right. Terrorism doesn't pose much of a threat. If you took all of the people killed by terrorists in the last 25 years, you wouldn't have 100,000 people dead. We kill 100,000 people in the United States alone in traffic accidents, boys and girls. 40,000 a year. 2.5 years is 100,000. If the terrorists could shoot down a 747 every day for 365 days with 500 people on board, you could only kill 182,500. There are more than 1,600 flights per day in the United States. Now, there aren't 500 people on all those airplanes, and I don't believe for a moment that they could pick an airplane with 500 passengers on it and shoot one of those down every day. But even if they could, it'd be under 200,000 a year. The Global 2000 Blueprint calls for the reduction of the Earth's population by 90% in the next 50 years. I'll bet you that you haven't heard very much about Global 2000, and yet it's a part of U.S. government policy. Have you heard about contrails, chemtrails, or contrails? That's those airplanes that you see up in the sky that are spreading those trails that look like the exhaust from jet airplanes. But if you'll look at a jet airplane go by, the exhaust from it disappears very rapidly. But if you'll look at these trails that you see from the airliners, or in this case spray planes, those trails stay up there for hours, and they spread out into what look like clouds. And that cloud layer contains 23 toxic chemicals, protozoa, and carcinogens that cause cancer, upper respiratory disease. And that program has been going on as a matter of U.S. policy and U.S. law since 1989. I'll bet you haven't heard much about that, but it's a part of the Global 2000 program to increase the death rate among the elderly through flus and pneumonia, which will exacerbate, or in this case, depending upon what side you're on, it will alleviate world population, or it will exacerbate the death rate. Now, however you want to word that. Now, in Exodus chapter 23, verses 22 through 33, God says, "I'll be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. Nobody's going to mess with you, and if they mess with you, they're messing with me." In Exodus 15:26, he said, "I will lay none of these diseases upon you." Now, in 1900, the death rate in the United States from cancer was nearly non-existent. In fact, your chances of getting cancer were only 1 in 33 in 1900. Today, it's 1 in 2, and by the year 2020, it'll be 1 out of 1. So if you thought that the American Medical Association and the American Cancer Society were working to eradicate cancer, I think you made a mistake. Those two institutions, along with the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, are working as hard as they can to increase the cancer rate, and they have. They've increased it from 1 in 33 to 1 in 1 in the next 20 years. Now, that's success. That's not good for you, and it's not good for me. But you know, over the next 20 years, I'm going to work very hard to avoid cancer, avoid heart attack, avoid terrorists. In fact, I'm going to work hard to avoid these 64 life-threatening problems that you can read about yourself in Leviticus chapter 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28. Those two chapters are the penal clause chapters in the Bible. Penal clause. You see, you got a contract. Now, while patriots are thinking about donning their camouflage suits and their Uzi submachine guns, it's my contention that submachine guns and Uzis are not the solution to bubonic plague, the reduction of the Earth's population by 90%, or AIDS, mad cow disease, chemtrails, terrorists, war, starvation, national captivity, smallpox, disease, plague. Doesn't have anything to do with that. Furthermore, the world's food supply right now is 38 days. In 1972, it was 70 days. 70 days. Today, it's half that. The population today is 2 billion higher than it was in 1970. And the world's population is growing exponentially. It'll double to 12 billion over the next 25 years. And the AIDS epidemic is now pandemic. That is, it affects everybody in the world. And in fact, the AIDS epidemic today is two-thirds the size of the bubonic plague epidemic of 1348, and it's growing exponentially. Every 3 years, it doubles. So AIDS doubles 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. It doubles every 3 years. An airliner shot down every day grows arithmetically 500, 1,000, 500, 2,000, 500, 3,000, 500, 4,000. AIDS grows 1 million, 2 million, 4 million, 8 million, 16 million, 32 million. It's at 45 million people worldwide are now AIDS or HIV positive. 25% of the population of South Africa, 38% of the population of Botswana. And in China, they now have 1 million, and the rate is growing exponentially every 3 years. By the year 2010, they'll have 10 million AIDS positive. Now, that's worldwide, and it's globally threatening to your health, safety, and welfare. You've got a greater chance of dying from AIDS, mad cow disease, chemtrails, national captivity and starvation. In fact, everything that I've mentioned is way ahead of terrorism, and yet your government is spending billions on terrorists and terrorism to keep your mind off of what's really going on around you, what's really threatening to kill you. And that's what subsistence and survival is all about. It actually comes from the Bible, because God Himself is the author of the end time collapse of the world's civilization. It's called the Great Tribulation in the Bible. The Great Tribulation. And this Great Tribulation is a problem that is going to affect 90% of the people. In fact, it's going to affect 100% of the people, but 90% of them are going to die, and God Himself said He's going to kill 90%. And you'll see that in Isaiah 6, verse 13 and 14. He says, I'm going to save a tithe or a tenth alive. So when the global 2,000 people come in from the Club of Rome, and they say, well, our objective, our goal is to reduce the Earth's population of useless eaters by 90% over the next 50 years, it dovetails with Bible prophecy. And what God is doing is He is using the New World Order and the global 2,000 people to affect that end. Now the question arises, what are your chances of being one of those 10? That's 1 out of 10 who survives it. Well, your chances aren't very good. And they're not very good because you don't practice the Mosaic Law, which is the 7th or the 8th class that I'm going to bring up. I'll tell you about the Mosaic Law in a little while. But the reason that the law of God is so important is because there are 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments in the Scripture. One of those laws is called Thou Shalt Not Commit Adultery. Now, adultery is a sport in the United States. And the people that participate in this sport don't understand the deadly consequences that come from it. You see, there's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. If there was, if you could have a law without a penalty, then you wouldn't have a law, you'd have a suggestion. Now, a law has a penalty. So when God comes along and says that the penalty for sin is death, that is, the penalty for Sabbath breaking is death, the penalty for adultery is death, either He's whistling Dixie through a straw hat, or we have misunderstood the seriousness of this thing called sin. Now, religious people will tell you plainly that the law is abolished and done away with, nailed to the cross with Jesus, and we don't have to be concerned with it. But I don't think that's true. And I don't think it's true because the penalties for the violation of these laws are still in full force and effect. Now, you can sit there and say, well, Jesus didn't mean to kill people any longer. with stones because of adultery. I don't believe that's true, but even if it was true, venereal disease, AIDS, and STDs are doing a much more effective job worldwide on this problem of adultery than stoning could ever have accomplished. You know, AIDS is final. Now, there's another disease that's final that I should bring to your attention here while we're talking about diseases, and it's called infectious diseases. And since the mid-1970s, they've recorded about 30 new infectious diseases, almost all originating in Africa, such as dengue fever, Ebola, hantavirus, as well as the return of malaria, cholera, and other age-old killers like smallpox. Now, in the United States, they're talking already about vaccinating the entire population. They now have enough smallpox vaccine to vaccinate everybody in the United States, and typically when they do that with a law of general applicability, which is called mandatory inoculations. Now, I'm going to avoid that, and there's a legal methodology for doing that to avoid inoculation. It normally kills, they tell us, about 2 or 3 people per million vaccinated. But when we take a look at history where vaccination, compulsory vaccination, was actually practiced, the Philippines is a good example, England is another one, France, all the countries of Europe, we find that with the increase in vaccination, we have the increase in smallpox. And that with a decrease in vaccination, there's a decrease in smallpox. So when vaccinations make their entry in the United States, the total potential based upon the number killed the last time around, that is from 1880 to 1920, would be 10 million in the United States. 10 million, not 2 or 3 per million. And I suspect that the reason that it will be that serious, or it could be that bad, I say could be because, you know, there's no way to tell how many people are going to die. When it was done in Egypt, for instance, the number of people that died was in the thousands. When they did it in the Philippines, it was 70,000 that died from the vaccine. When they did it in England, it was around 200,000 that died from the vaccine in the 1880s. And with the decline of the population's immune system in the United States, you know, with such things as, AIDS, herpes, and VD, AIDS is an immune-depressing disease. And anytime that you've got a disease that attacks the immune system or is an immune-suppressant disease, and then you come along and give that person a shot of smallpox or, you know, they become exposed to flu or a virus, they get sick. So infectious diseases, then, are a big problem. And it's a sleeper. It's a sleeper waiting for Revelation 6, where God says that he's going to use disease to kill 25%, that is a fourth part of the earth's population. So the people who are in the process of distributing Revelation 6 are your government officials in Washington, D.C., London, Paris, and Berlin. Those are your real enemies. Those are the real threats. It's your own government in your own country that is the real threat to your life over the next 50 years. So I just thought I'd point that out. Now, I've said over the air a number of times that we need to do something intelligent and constructive to give ourselves the best possible edge, best possible chance of turning up in that 10% that survives. Remember, the people that are carrying this out intend to survive it. You know, people like Prince Philip, who said that he would like to come back as a virus or a bacteria so that he could reduce the Earth's population. Now, that's just real neat, isn't it? That guy intends to survive this. and his family. He intends that his family survive it, and I intend to survive it, and I intend that my family survive it, and you can too. But you're going to have to get into compliance. Now, let me show you what I say or what I mean by this thing called compliance. If you take a look at the 133 titles of law contained in the Bible, now let me break this down for you. The Bible has 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments divided into 133 laws. That's all there is. There are laws concerning integration, Christmas, pork, Easter, interracial marriage, unjust weights and balances, witchcraft, sodomy, abortion, adultery, usury, voting, blood, fat, census, schools, wills, you know. Now, there are more than one statute that regulates unjust weights and balances, witchcraft, sodomy, abortion, adultery, usury, voting, blood, fat, and the census, and so on. But there's only 133 laws, 133 subject matters. And out of the 133 laws contained in the scripture, we Americans are still practicing 52 as a nation, 52, and we violate 81. Now, I don't know how many abortions it's going to take, or how many sodomites it's going to take, or how much adultery, or how much usury it'll take to destroy the nation. I do know that we have not done it yet. We have not succeeded as of this moment in time. But we are doing everything in our power to accomplish that goal. There's a limit to abortion, sodomy, and witchcraft. We haven't reached that limit yet, but it's not because of any lack of trying on our part. And at some point in time, like Sodom and Gomorrah, which are mentioned in the New Testament a time or two, as being examples that we ought to learn from. My common sense tells me, you know, I'm just a crummy plumber, but you know, my common sense says that if you're going to give God the finger, that at some point in time, he's going to react to that. Well, now that's assuming, of course, that there's a God. Most people believe in evolution, that there is no God, so we don't have a problem. There isn't going to be any comeuppance at some point in time. There's never any retribution. This is taught both in church and in public school. But I want to hedge my bet, just in case there is a God, and just in case we didn't evolve from green algae, and just in case the Club of Rome, and just in case the Global 2000 people mean what they say and say what they mean in their publications, I want to give myself the best possible edge. And I figured that the best way to do that would be to swear off of such high-risk activities as sodomy, witchcraft, Sabbath breaking, and eating unclean meat. Now, if you are of a mind like I am to exercise a little discretion here before we go whole hog into this New World Order program, this United Nations program, and you want to learn how to hedge your bet, then I would like to suggest subsistence and survival. And we'll start with these 64 life-threatening problems. We'll take a look at Global 2000, and I'll show you step 1, step 2, step 3. And we'll take a look at this from the biblical perspective, because I think that God and the Bible have the best solution for the Global 2000 nightmare. I think it's a better solution than Uzi submachine guns and camouflage suits and 10,000 bullets. Now, I took a look at Waco, I took a look at Ruby Ridge, and I analyzed that in some detail, and I came to the conclusion that if I could avoid that, I think I'd be money ahead. And the same thing is true now with the terrorist threat. I think I'd like to avoid that terrorist threat. So if I stay out of high-rise buildings, in fact, if I stay out of high population density areas like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, New Orleans, Seattle, Dallas, Houston, I think if I stay away from those places as much as possible, that I'm going to increase my chances of avoiding that nuclear weapon smuggled into the United States from Iraq, North Korea, or Russia or someplace else, Pakistan, India, in a container, on a container ship. You know, if you just torched off one of those nuclear weapons, let's say in San Francisco Harbor, over, you know, on the Oakland side, I think that that would just about collapse our economy, and that's one of our 64 life-threatening problems. We need to have a way to make a living that's outside of the economy, outside of the system. You know, I don't think I want to be tied to the U.S. economy when the thing turns turtle. I think I'd like to be able to provide my food, clothing, and shelter from some other source other than working at Boeing Aircraft, General Motors, or IBM. Don't you? All right, now this class is a 5-day school, as are most of my schools, 5 days. And if you want more information, why don't you just go ahead and call the law school. This school is also on CD, it's on compact disc, and the paperwork is about 500 pages. It's a 3-inch binder, and we'll take you through 20 steps that will get you or give you the best possible odds or chances of living through this, kind of like Noah and the Ark. What is the best possible chance of living through the Great Flood? And that was with an ark. And your best possible chance of living through this Global 2000 and the New World Order, I think, is from Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 and these 64 life-threatening problems. If you knew what to prepare for and you could prepare for those, God kind of had in mind that He was going to save about 10% of us alive. And I think practicing the law of God is the best possible scenario. So why don't you give us a call here, the telephone number 417-273-4967, or just go to the webpage, it's georgegordon.net, georgegordon.net, click onto the email machine, send me an email request. Hey, we'll take up how to make $100,000 on 25 acres right after this, standby. Okay, we're back. Let's take a look at this thing of how to make $100,000 on 25 acres or less. Well, during the 1970s, an obscure black college professor at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, working on a grant, by the way, that was a Rockefeller grant, if you can believe it, $250,000, he developed a unique marketing plan for agricultural products. Once they did this, the Rockefeller money dried up. Once they showed that, yeah, we could do this, this is not something that the New World Order wanted accomplished. The plan was aimed at poor rural black landowners in the South who owned small acreages. Now, some of these acreages are as small as 3 acres. 3 acres. You can make $100,000 a year. I'll show you how. Now, the goal was to keep these landowners on the land by producing produce for sale to the public at retail and to generate an income that would support a family. Well, $100,000 a year, gross, will support a family. Now, the cost of production is about 50% of what you get out of a business enterprise. That's what we call a keystone markup. Keystone markup. You buy it for a dollar, you sell it for two. And that's called a keystone. Now, in agriculture, you have a tremendous amount of input. You have chemicals and sprays, and you have labor. This operation is a four-man operation. It's a man, his wife, and two teenage children. It's a four-man operation. If you don't have two children that will work on the farm with you, then you're going to have to spend some money on labor. These are called you-pick operations, and you do as much as you can to create a you-pick operation where the customer picks the produce. And you put in a store. The Whatley program was so successful that it became known as the Whatley program, how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less. That guy's name was Booker T. Whatley. There are about 4,000 of these small family enterprises operating in the United States today. 4,000. Now, there are approximately 33.6 million people, about 12% of the population, are into health food and organic. And that's spread all over the country. There's 12% of the population in North Dakota, and 12% of the population in New York, and 12% of the population in California. You can sell this produce wholesale to health food stores, but it's better if you sell your produce retail to your own customers. And so what Whatley developed was a retail marketing program where you go out and pre-sell the produce. You need 100 customers. You go to a health food store, you start talking to people who are into health foods. Would you like to contract with me to grow your food? For instance, right now, our family uses approximately 600 pounds of potatoes a year. And I would like to buy 600 pounds of potatoes a year from somebody that grows organic potatoes. I don't want to buy Monsanto New Leaf Superior potatoes that are BT and Roundup Ready. I don't want to buy that. That's what they sell in the supermarket. Now, if you had potatoes, or let me put it this way, if you had any kind of produce, fruits, vegetables, meat, and etc., I would buy it from you in a heartbeat. Let me ask you the same question. Would you pay retail for organic produce? You're already paying retail for chemically produced produce in your supermarket. So if somebody would come to you and say, I've got organic potatoes, meat, milk, butter, and eggs, would you buy that from me and just pay me the same price you're now paying down at the local retail store? Would you do that? Well, most people would. Now, the average housewife is spending about $5,000 a year in the supermarket. All you want from her is $1,000. You want 20% of her food budget being spent with you on your little farm. And so what they derived, or what they created was a little farm. You divide the thing up, and you plant just what other people want to buy, what your customers want to buy. So when 100 of your customers, and this is about all you can service, is about 100 people at about $1,000 each with you, your wife, and your two children. And when you put this little operation together, you're growing just what these people want to buy. You ask, well, how many potatoes do you buy? Well, I buy about 10 pounds a week. Well, that's about 500 pounds a year, 10 pounds a week. Now, 100 pounds of potatoes, if you sold those potatoes at 10 cents a pound, they'd be about $10 a hundred, or about $60 or $70 for a year's supply of potatoes. And customers come to your store. Now, here was a neat little operation that I've seen in some of these other, a lot of these little mom-and-pop operations. You don't have to grow everything there on your own farm. For instance, if you're up in North Dakota, you may not have peaches, but you know there are organic peach producers all over. So what you do is you buy peaches from organic sources. And there's a lot of organic sources that you can find in Acres, USA. Acres, USA. People that have organic corn, wheat, beans, fruit, vegetables. And what you don't have, you can buy, and you can buy these at different times of the year. For instance, if you're in North Dakota, you may not have carrots, but they'll have carrots in January in the Rio Grande Valley and in Salinas, California. And what you do is you ship them in. But you have to make sure that you're buying organic and that you're selling organic. Now, health food stores are basically in the business of selling pills. You ever notice that? Go into your local health food store. They've got some beans and they've got a few things in there, but they don't have fresh fruits and vegetables, which is what customers want to buy, and that's where the U-Pick operation comes in. So here at the farm, we have some raised beds that we've put together, and so that I can demonstrate and I can show you how to put a $100,000 farm together. For instance, let me give you an illustration as to the value of a bed. Let's suppose that we take a bed, a raised bed, 6.5 feet wide by 60 feet long. And you've got about 400 square feet there, 6 by 60. And that little half foot in here is about 400 square feet. And you practice what we call square foot gardening, which was developed by Rodale. Now, there are a lot of organic sources. There's a lot of organic books out there, whether you're into organic or not. But if you plant garlic or lettuce, cabbage, that cabbage sells for about 50 cents a pound in the store. A head of cabbage is about 3 pounds. And let's suppose that we can sell that cabbage for 50 cents a pound, or let's get 33 cents a pound for it. A 3-pound head of lettuce is worth $1. And there's 400 square feet in a bed, and it will grow just about 400 cabbages. That's $400. Now think about that in terms of an acre. An acre has 43,560 square feet in it. Now let's talk about 3 acres, because 43,560 square feet. Now take out your house and your buildings, and you plant your 3 acres in truck crop like cauliflower, cabbage, rutabaga, berries, fruit, and you're shooting for $1 a square foot. That's why 3 acres will produce $100,000 a year. So if you've just got a little place and you've got 2 or 3 acres on there, you know you can make your living. In fact, if you've got a place in the city, I've mentioned this a time or two, just 50 by 100 square feet. That's a lot, just a lot, 50 by 100 in the city. You can grow 2,000 square feet of vegetables on your own property. Think of that. That's 2,000 square feet will feed a family of 6 year-round. 2,400 square feet is about what you need to feed a family of 6 year-round. All right, now, the Whatley people did a great job, but those people didn't care whether you used organic or whether you practiced chemical farming. So we took the chemical farming out of the Whatley program, and we added the 15 agricultural laws. Now, God gave us 15 laws and told us, you practice these 15 laws and you can have sustainable agriculture forever. And of course, a question arises, is agriculture a chemical soup or is it a living organism? Now, when you go to public school, they teach evolution and that you came from a living soup. And, of course, farming today is little more than chemical farming. It's like hydroponics. All we're going to do is feed this plant chemicals. And, indeed, they will grow. And they will produce. You can grow hydroponic tomatoes. They taste like wallpaper paste. And they don't have any nutrients in them. But they are tomatoes. And people sell them. Now, why don't we grow on an organic living organism called soil? Because it contains 186,000 organisms in the soil. And if all of those organisms are in there, in balance, you won't have any insect problems at all. Because insects only eat weak, sick plants. That's what they're designed for. So the reason that the farmer is having a problem with insects is that he never practices the land Sabbath, which is one of those 15 agricultural laws. So we have to learn about the land Sabbaths. Hybridize seed. You know, there's a law that says you shall not sow your seed with, or your field with mingled seed. That's hybridized seed. That seed produces produce that is anywhere from 75% short on protein to 600% short on iron, 345% short on copper, and so on down the line. You've probably heard me mention that over the radio a time or two. Then there's the landmark laws, cattle laws, landmarks, and the soil. How do you maintain that soil? I can show you how to do all of that. And indeed, I think that it's a better form of agriculture than chemical agriculture. In fact, if you're going to practice chemical agriculture, I would say you probably need some other kind of business, because American agriculture has been using chemicals and practicing chemical agriculture for about 100 years, and it's no longer self-sustaining, and American agriculture is going into the tank. And I think if you do it, you'll go right into the tank with them. What we need is a change. We need a change back to what works. And what works are the agricultural laws that God gave us out at Mount Sinai for the express purpose of maintaining soil fertility and human health, which is the basic reason for eating. It's health. Now, when you eat potatoes that are lacking in vitamins and minerals, you're going to get cancer, muscular dystrophy, or heart attack. So are the people who buy your produce. Now, this marketing plan only includes 100 customers. That's all you need is 100. You want $1,000, 20% from each of your customers out of their marketing budget, to pay you to grow what they want to buy. And you don't grow what people don't want to buy. Take their order, and then you go out and you plant it and grow it. So the marketing plan includes 100 customers at $1,000 each. What we're looking for here is a gross program or a gross sale of $100,000 a year. What does it cost to produce it? Well, let's suppose that you don't own a piece of ground and you need to go buy a piece. Would you like to learn how to buy a piece of ground? No money down, no interest, no carrying charges. Do you think you could make a real estate deal like that in America today? I've made many of them, and I've shown people how to do that, the no money down trick. So, in school, we'll show you how to buy a piece of ground if you don't have it. If you've got a piece of ground, are you using it to its maximum potential? Have you thought about putting in a little operation to make that ground pay for itself? You know, if you're paying $500 a month payments on a piece of real estate, and you're working someplace to make the $500, what happens if you lose your job? Have you thought about that? That's why I mentioned in the last segment, I need a methodology whereby I can make a living outside the system. Now, if you're making a living and you work at Boeing or IBM or some place and you're making your living, that's fine. There's no problem with that. But why don't you think about, gee, what if I lost my job? Could I feed, clothe, and house myself? And could I produce a little extra for some people down the street? You know, back in the Depression years, people were really scrambling to make ends meet. When I was a kid during World War II, everybody had a victory garden. Everybody grew something. And what we didn't have, Mrs. Birchfield had. What Mrs. Birchfield didn't have, what Mrs. Johnson had. And those people, you know, when you have three or four pear trees, you're going to have more pears than you can eat. You take those surplus pears and trade it to somebody that's got apples. And the guy that's got apples, you're trading your squash for, or you're trading cucumbers or something else. Now, people will drive 40 miles to buy organic produce. The Watley program, they thought that what you needed to do was to locate this farm or your store within 40 miles of a population area of 50,000 people. We discovered that you only need 100 customers, and 12% of the population is interested in organic produce. Now, if you're living in an area that's producing a lot of organic produce already, then you've got competition. And what you need is 100 customers that will buy from you. So you go out and you get 5 customers. And then you go out and you get 5 more. Here's the trick. You know, people, it's kind of like this. Birds of a feather flock together. So if you came to me and you sold me on the idea of organic produce, I would tell 10 of my friends. Those 10 friends all have 10 friends who in turn have 10 friends who in turn have 10 friends. Now, the people that don't eat organic do not have 10 organic friends. I mean, it's just, that's the way life is. So you go over to some guy who's a Catholic and he's going to have 10 Catholic friends. You go to some guy who's a Republican, he's going to have 10 Republican friends. You go to some guy that buys his food down here at Walmart and he's going to have 10 friends that buy from Walmart. I mean, that's just where reality's at. Now, the store, as you progress along in your program, I mean, we start this thing at zero COD. We go out and we start looking for five customers. So you've got to go out and find five customers, but five customers have 10 friends, that's 50. Those 50 have 10 friends, that's 500. Now, you've got to be able to perform. So we need to teach you how, not only how to market it, but how to grow it. And there's a program here developed by Rodale called Companion Planning. Companion planting. And we learned that from the Indians. You know, the Indians, they used to plant beans, corn, and squash on the same piece of ground. So we pay attention to Rodale, the Indians, and other organic growers, and especially Acres USA. And if we're going to get into the business, then we want to find out, well, how do the other guys do it? And by doing that, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, there are other fellows that have already been out there doing this. There's other people out there that have organic seed. There's other people out there that have open pollinated seed. There's other people out there that are marketing and can show you how to do the same thing. And so birds of a feather flock together. So I buy organic. And I'm always looking for organic. Everybody that eats organic is always looking for organic. Well, who else has got this? Who else has got this product? So we put a store in, and in the store we can start adding items just like a health food store. What do you need for a store? You need an outbuilding, you need a garage, you need some place on your property. Maybe you have to build one. Maybe you'll have to buy one, have it moved in. You know, these little metal buildings, it doesn't take very much money to buy one of these little metal buildings. And most of your business is going to be done in about 6 months, starting in March through about the end of November, and you're going to be just about completed. So you're only talking about working maybe 6-7 months a year. Not bad. $100,000 a year is what you're shooting for. And you can do that in about 36 months. So you don't quit your job in the morning and go out here and try to do this. What you do is you start doing this on the side, and you start off with 5 customers, and then you move up to 10. Then from 10 to 20, and 20 to 40, 40 to 80. And in about 3 or 4 years, you can have 100 customers producing $100,000 a year on a piece of ground that you may not own today, but if you do own it, we could start producing on that ground right away, next spring. And if your ground is not organic now, we can go to work on creating organic soil, creating an organic garden. How big a piece of ground do you need? How big is an acre? Well, you know, you can buy little tractors, the little small 25, 30 horsepower tractors like a Ford 8N or the old Alice Chalmers. You know, those tractors are around for $500 or $1,000. And the old implements that go with them, you know, they're really dirt cheap. And they're dirt cheap because farming in America has failed. Everybody's gone into mass production. What they're trying to do now is go into monoculture. What we want to do is agriculture. We want to grow 40 different crops, 40 different things. And that's because the more variety that you have to sell, then the greater is the appeal when Mary Housewife wants to drive out here 10, 20, 30 miles to your store in your little farm. And it makes an experience for the family. And pretty soon, you'll put in a pond. And in that pond, you'll stock fish. And when you stock fish in the pond, then your customers come out and pay you a fee to catch the fish that you've stocked in the pond, which is another source of income. So the pond serves as irrigation, and it also serves as a cash cow when Mom and Dad come out to pick raspberries, and the children go over to catch fish in the pond and then pay you to go fishing. These kinds of operations have been around for a long time. They're not brand new. In fact, we have one in this county. It's a trout farm in which you pay. They'll furnish you with the equipment that you need, the fishing pole and the bait and everything you want. And you just go out here and catch your fish, and then you just pay for the fish as you catch them. Catch six fish, you're buying six fish. Now, that's called a you-pick operation because, you see, the owner is selling fish that you caught or you picked. And so you do the same thing with raspberries, blackberries, and so on. Now, let me give you a closer here. What do you think the most valuable crop is? Marijuana? No, it's raspberries at $43,000 an acre. Blackberries, $22,000 an acre. Blueberries, $8,000 an acre. Peaches, $8,000 an acre. Strawberries, $4,000 an acre. Soybeans, about $300 an acre. Why would we want to grow soybeans, wheat, and corn when there is so little in it? When we can be growing the vegetables and crops for little mom-and-pop customers that are going to be paying the retail price, and it's worth a dollar a square foot, $43,000 an acre. Now, that's what we're shooting for. All right, now this class is also available on CD, as is all of our schools. They're on CD. I like to recommend that you come to school because if you can see, get your fingers in the dirt, and you can actually walk around and see how it's done, you know, it adds an awful lot to the program. If you can't, you can always come to school at a later date. You can take the program on CD. And you can come to school. Now, we also have another program here we've been involved in for many, many years, and it's very simple. Once you go to school here, if you want to come back and bone up next year or the year after, you can come back free. So once you've paid for the class, you can come back as many times as you want and catch up, bone up on what's new. Remember the phone number. It's 417-273-4967. And we're online, georgegordon.net. Click onto the email machine, send me an email request. Stand by, and we'll be right back with the last school that we offer here called the Mosaic Law. Hang on. All right, school number 8, the Mosaic Law School, which covers 133 titles of law. That is, all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments in the Bible, along with all the penalties. There are 24 crimes that are punishable by death, 24 capital felonies, 28 ways to punish somebody, 28 different punishments, 133 subjects of law. We cover all of those, and the importance to that is bound up in this concept or this little story. I was up in Marengo, Illinois here some years back, 1983. It's quite a while now, nearly 20 years. And a preacher sitting in the front row of my tax school said to me, "You're teaching all of these people to lose their salvation." I don't know what brand of preacher he was, but Jesus never had any use for preachers, bankers, or lawyers. And you can read that in Luke chapter 11. Luke 11. Verses 37 through 54. He'll tell you what he thought about lawyers and preachers. I don't discriminate against preachers the way Jesus did, but I guess he had a good reason for it. Anyway, this preacher said, "You're teaching all these people to lose their salvation." I said, "Well, why do you say that?" And he said, "Well, because you're teaching this Old Testament law, which has been abolished." Now, that's pretty common fare. If you were to ask 100 Christians if the law of God is in full force and effect today, I think 100 of them would tell you no. Certainly the overwhelming majority, 99%, 98%. It's the common belief among Christian people. Well, I'm not a religious person. I don't delve into religion. I'm pretty astute, though, on the law. And so I look at the Bible as a law book. In fact, So did Harvard Law School. Until 1942, they started incoming freshmen on two books. Blackstone's Commentaries, number one, and the Book of Hebrews, number two. And indeed, all of our founding fathers were well-versed in the Bible, and George Washington said that without morality, you can't have a republican form of government. And indeed, we couldn't. And we now have degenerated into a communist proletariat. People who don't practice the law of God don't practice morality. Well, this preacher said to me that I was teaching these people to lose their salvation. Now, that's kind of religious. And I said, well, I don't think that's true. I believe that the entire law of God is in full force and effect today, right now, today. That was 1983. I think it is right now, today. And then I said, well, let me test this. Let's see. Maybe you've got a point here. And behind me was a whiteboard, so I wrote on the whiteboard 759. And then I turned to him and I said, you've heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. And he said, yeah. And I said, well, pilgrim, I want to take your wife home and sleep with her tonight. Can you tell me what's wrong with that? Now, he mulled that one over for a few seconds in his mind. There were about 10 or 15 people who were on break and kind of standing around there, just jawboning a little bit. And these people were pretty interested in this preacher's response, and the preacher said, well, that wouldn't be showing love to your neighbor. So I said, well, neighbor, I don't love you. I hate you. But I love your wife. And she's the one that I want to sleep with. Can you tell me what's wrong with that? Well, he mulled that one over a little bit, and he said, well, that law hasn't been abolished. So I turned back to my whiteboard, and I put a 1 under that 759 with a minus sign, and I wrote the sum. It was 758. And I said, now, you've heard it said by them of old time, thou shalt not steal. And he said, yep. Now, I had a tape recorder there. He was recording this. And it was plugged in, and the tape was going round and round. He was sitting there in the front row with his wife, and I reached down, and I took the cord, and I yanked on it and jerked it right out of the wall, picked up his tape recorder, looked him right in the eyeballs, and said, mine. And I turned on my heel, and I took a few steps, and he was so shocked at that aberrant behavior that he said, that's my tape recorder. I whirled around and I said, no, it isn't. It's mine. I just took it. And we're practicing from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. The law that says thou shalt not steal has been abolished, repealed, rescinded, and nailed to the cross with Jesus. Remember, pilgrim? He mulled that one over a little bit and he said, well, that law hasn't been abolished either. So I turned around and I put a 1 under the 758. Drew a line and the sum was 757. And I said, you know, there's 757 more laws that are just like that. And every one of those laws is in full force and effect today. And every one of those laws has a reason. And he looked at me and he said, well, what about the ceremonial laws? And I said, what about them? Because if the ceremonial laws, or if any law, was repealed, abolished, nailed to the cross with Jesus, then it goes against what Jesus said in Matthew 5, verses 17. You know, Matthew 5, 17. You ever look at that? He said, think not that I've come to destroy the law of the prophets. I didn't come to destroy, but to fulfill. For truly I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Now the preachers come along and say, see, he fulfilled the law, he did it all. And now that he's done it all, you don't have to do it anymore. Verse 19, he says, whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments, least commandments. Not something major like thou shalt not commit adultery, which carries a capital penalty, death, but maybe something, you know, like you shall not let your cattle gender with a diverse kind, or you shall not sow your seed with mingled, or your field with mingled seed, or you shall not allow or let a garment of mixed linen wool come upon you. I mean, those are the kind of laws that are kind of least commandments, wouldn't you say? And yet here's Jesus says, whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments in Leviticus 19:19, and shall teach men so, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. I just kind of had my mind on being called great. That's all. Instead of being called least, I'd like to be called great. So I teach even the least commandments. Now that preacher could see that thou shalt not commit adultery and thou shalt not steal were still kind of important. We still practice those laws in the United States to some degree. You know, if you get caught trying to nail somebody's wife, you're liable to get shot, aren't you? Yeah, that's a real risk and a real possibility. Now, let's test another little portion here of the law. Did you know that every Old Testament law is contained in the New Testament by a direct quotation, such as in Matthew 4, verse 4, which says, man doesn't live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. That was cited from Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. Or by an example, such as muzzling the ox in 1 Timothy 5:18, which is cited from the law of Moses, or by a reference such as the fringe statute, which you read in Matthew 9:20. The fringe statute is cited from Deuteronomy 22:12. 1 Timothy 5:8, muzzling the ox, is cited from Deuteronomy 25:4. Matthew 4:4 is cited from Deuteronomy 8:3. There are 759 of these statutes, judgments, and commandments, 133 titles of law. They're all repeated in the New Testament. I can identify all of them. I don't know why that preacher couldn't. I'm a crummy plumber. He's been to cemetery. Now, the reason that he can't is because the Bible is written in code. It's a law book. It's not a religious book. It's a law book. And it's written in code, and you have to learn how to code plead it. It's called code pleading. And Isaiah 28, verse 9 through 13 explains that code. Now listen to this. Whom shall he teach knowledge? This is Isaiah 28, 9. Whom shall he teach knowledge, and whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Them that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breasts. This isn't for babies. Verse 10. For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. Precept is a statute, so it's statute upon statute, line upon line. There's a little here and a little there. And in verse 11 he says, with stammering lips and another tongue will I speak to this people. So here's God comes along and he says, you know, I'm going to speak to you people with stammering lips and another tongue. I'm going to speak to you in German and stutter. Hey, that's not conducive to learning, is it? Verse 13, he said, but the word of the Eternal was unto them precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little and there a little, that they might go and fall backward and be broken and snared and taken. It was written this way so that you would fall backward, be broken and snared and taken. The Bible isn't for everybody to understand. It's written in code. There's the code. Now over here in Matthew chapter 13, there's a unique story. I'm going to tell you the story. It's the story of the parable of the sower. It's in Matthew 13. I went to Sunday school twice when I was a kid. Two times. I remember both lessons. One of them was the parable of the sower, and the other one was Daniel in the lion's den. Just goes to show you that I've got some good, solid religious upbringing. Now, the difference is that most people went to Sunday school every day of their life and can't remember jack squat. I went twice and remember both of them. Let me tell you this one. Matthew 13, Jesus goes out and he gets in a boat and he's talking to a bunch of people on the shore, and he tells them this story about the parable of the sower. In verse 10, his disciples came up and said, "Hey, boss, how come you're talking to these people in parables?" Now, Mrs. Ray, our Sunday school teacher, when I went to Sunday school in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, the only group on planet Earth that's going to heaven, everybody else is going to hell. I got that right straight out of my Sunday school teacher and my preacher. So, just wanted you people out there to know in Bible land that unless you belong to the right corporation and the right church, it's curtains for you. Isn't that what all these churches teach? If you don't belong to our group and our corporation, it's all over for you. You're going to hell. Well, he's talking to these people, and his disciples said, "Gosh, he's speaking to these people in parables." Mrs. Ray, the Sunday school teacher, said from our Sunday school lesson, the reason Jesus spoke in parables is because these poor ignorant people were dumb farmers, and they weren't like you lucky boys and girls and went to school so they could be educated and read and write. See, these people are dumb and they're farmers. Hey, I'm a farmer, and I didn't know that farmers were all dumb. In fact, I thought us farmers were pretty smart guys. Furthermore, now who said these people never went to school? There's nothing here in the Bible that says whether they went to school or not. Furthermore, it never said anything in Matthew 13 about whether or not they were farmers. We don't know what their occupation was. They might have been engineers and preachers and camel jockeys and tradesmen. I mean, you know, they could have been a couple of plumbers, carpenters, or electricians in there. How do we know? Anyway, that's religion for you. You know, they just kind of assume facts, not in evidence. And in verse 11, Jesus answered. Now, what's the question? Are you paying attention now, boys and girls? Pay attention. Here's the question. Why are you speaking to these people in parables? And Jesus answered. He said, "Because it's given to you to know the mystery of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it isn't given." Just exactly what we saw in Isaiah 28, wasn't it? I'm going to speak to these people with stammering lips and another tongue so they don't understand what I'm telling them. Now, I know, you got all these missionaries running around the world, especially in Africa, trying to teach these natives over here to sing, "Yes, Jesus loves me," so that they can go to heaven and be with Jesus, but that isn't what Jesus told you. And, of course, your preacher and what he tells you is a hell of a lot more important than what Jesus tells you. I mean, this guy's got the straight skinny. Jesus got his head in his rectal ridge and doesn't know what he's talking about. Now, does he? Or, anyway, just maybe he knew something that we didn't know, so pay attention now, boys and girls. Verse 12, he said, "For whosoever has, to him shall be given, and he shall have more abundance, and whosoever has not, from him shall be taken away even that which he has." Now listen, that doesn't follow union policy, does it? And you know that if anybody actually practiced that today, we'd report him to the shop steward and file a grievance with the union, no? Wouldn't we? "Therefore I speak unto them in parables, because they seeing see not, and hearing they hear not, and neither do they understand, and in them is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah." Isaiah, remember? Isaiah 28, 9 through 13. "Which says, by hearing you shall hear, and you shall not understand, and seeing you shall see, and you shall not perceive. That's cited in Isaiah 6, verses 9 through 13. "Because this people's heart is waxed gross, their ears are full of hearing, or dull of hearing, and their eyes they have closed, lest at any time they should see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and they should be converted, and I should heal them." All right, so there's the answer. Now, there's 133 things here that you need to know about the law. And then there's some things in here called doctrines. You ever heard of a doctrine? Doctrine? You know, crazy things. Let me give you a couple of ideas about doctrines here. You know, like amen. Where does this word amen come from? You know, everybody prays and they go, "Amen, brother." That comes from Amenhotep, the Egyptian sun god. So you pray to Jesus, and then you close your prayer in the name of Amenhotep, the Egyptian sun god. Why do you do that? And then there's things in here, you know, like Christmas. Jesus, if you look in the encyclopedia, wasn't born on December 25th. How come you're practicing Christmas? And then there's crazy things, you know, like death, the Davidic covenant, marriage and divorce, medical doctors, Passover, days of unleavened bread. I mean, nobody in his right mind would practice Passover and days of unleavened bread when we've got Easter, Christmas, New Year's, 4th of July. You ever wonder why people practice those pagan holidays? Well, we cover those kinds of things here right out of the Scripture, 90 common doctrines. But I wanted to bring your attention to something here that God doesn't change. And it's called the doctrine of stare decisis. Stare decisis. Now, that's a Latin term. What that means is it's the same yesterday, today, and forever. That's what Jesus told us, remember, up here in Matthew 5:17. He said, "Think not that I've come to destroy the law." Well, the doctrine of stare decisis, or the basis for this doctrine, that the law doesn't change, that the law is the same yesterday, today, and forever, comes from the Bible. Yeah, that's right. God doesn't change. He says, "I change not. I'm the same yesterday, today, and forever. The Scripture cannot be broken, which God that cannot lie." God says that He doesn't lie. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever, and the Scripture cannot be broken. He says, "I change not, and man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." Now, that's a wild concept for Christians, isn't it? I mean, think about it. Have you ever heard of a Christian say that we should live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God? Did Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, Psalms, Proverbs, Esther, Nehemiah, Daniel, did any of those books, any of those words proceed out of the mouth of God? Hey, I'm not citing from the Old Testament, boys and girls. I'm citing this right out of Matthew 4:4 and Luke 4:4. Hebrews 13:8 says Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That's the basis of stare decisis. All right, now the opposite to that is res judicata. Now the First and Fourth Amendments to our Constitution are always decided by res judicata. That is on a case-by-case basis. But Miranda versus Arizona and Yoder versus Wisconsin are decided by stare decisis. So what is the rule of law in the Bible anyway? Is it res judicata or is it stare decisis? Does anybody know? Has anybody ever thought about it? So I just thought I'd point this out. Here in Malachi 3:6, he says, "For I am the Eternal, I change not, therefore you sons of Jacob are not consumed." Well, if God doesn't change, and he gave you a law that said thou shalt not commit adultery, well then, if stare decisis is the rule of law, then thou shalt not commit adultery is still the law today. Hasn't been repealed. Now, we Americans, we change our law every time we change our political parties. For instance, there was a time in America when we used to drink. And then we passed the 18th Amendment and we stopped drinking, and then we repealed the 18th Amendment and started drinking again. Those were the prohibition years, remember, in the 1920s? And we presume that the Bible works the same way. If there's a law in here that we don't like, why, we just don't practice that, and then we just tell everybody that law is done away with. But that's not what Jesus said. So he said, "Think not that I've come to destroy the law or the prophets, and I'll call you least in the kingdom of heaven if you teach anybody to violate one of these least commandments." I wonder what he would do to somebody that taught somebody to practice adultery, witchcraft, or Sabbath breaking. In Matthew 4:4 and Luke 4:4, "But he answered and said, It's written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." That's cited from Deuteronomy 8:3, where it says, "And he humbled you and suffered you to hunger, and he fed you with manna, which you knew not, neither did your fathers know, that he might make you to know that man does not live by bread only, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." does man live? Then there's Matthew 5:17 through 20, John 10, verse 35, the scripture cannot be broken. And Titus 1, verse 2, which God that cannot lie. Hebrews 13:8, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. No prophecy of the scriptures of any private interpretation. All scripture is given by inspiration of God, and all these things happen to them for example, so that they can learn from them. All of those statements that I just read to you come from the New Testament. That's the doctrine of stare decisis. Now, Jesus told you he didn't come to destroy the law, and he told you I'm the same yesterday, today, and forever. That's the basis of Miranda versus Arizona. Now, every word that proceeded out of the mouth of God is in full force and effect today, including the ceremonial laws. Now, before you hit the panic switch, I'm not practicing any sacrifices because all the sacrifices were always done by Levites and Aaronic priests. I'm not a Levite or an Aaronic priest, are you? Same thing with the Uniform Code of Military Justice. You know, I'm not a soldier in the Army, so I don't practice the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but I'm not telling anybody that the UCMJ has been abolished, nailed to the cross, and taken out of the way, and has been repealed. The Commerce Clause and all of the commerce statutes in our country today are in full force and effect. I just don't practice commerce, so those laws don't affect me. But if I opened a bank account, they sure would. And if you've got a bank account, they sure do. All right, well, there's the story on the Mosaic Law and the Mosaic Doctrines. Now, this class is divided into two groups. So I do the Mosaic Law, those 759 statutes, in the spring, and then in the fall of the year, I do the 90 common doctrines. And if you'd like to get these on CD, you can do that. They're on CD, and you can just call the law school. It's 417-273-4967 for more information, or you can go to our webpage, georgegordon.net. That's georgegordon.net. You just call. We're not going to sell your mailing list to somebody. We're not going to bite your head off. We won't try to sell you too much. Just call up and ask for information. We'd be happy to give it to you. All right, there's our eight schools, and it's been good talking to you, and we'll talk to you on the telephone as soon as you call. So until then, goodbye, friends.